You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, the corporate press and the linguistic cover-up of Israel's multiple slaughters in Gaza as the apartheid state continues its program of ethnic cleansing in Palestine. We'll be joined by Consortium News Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria and Ray McGovern, recently brutalized and arrested for protesting the fact that the next director of Central Intelligence is probably going to be a pro-torture activist. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Joe Loria. He's the new editor-in-chief of Consortium News. He is going to be in town this weekend. For those of you who are in the Bay Area, you might want to meet the new editor of Consortium News as we celebrate the life and times and the great work of Robert Perry, the founder of Consortium News and one of the finest journalists of our time. Joe Loria, welcome back to Flashpoints. I've been looking at your piece about, well, it's called U.S. Media Whitewashes Gaza Massacre, and you deal with the way in which the corporate media feels compelled to cover up the story. And they do it in two ways. It's to neutralize the linguistics and then to blame the victim. Could you please talk a little bit about how you lay that out in your piece?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis, for having me back. I think it's done reflexively, I want to first point out. I don't think they're sitting around at the news meeting and determining what's going on in the paper. Let's cover the story this way. I think this is the way most American reporters have been brought up. This is what they've received from the media, and they're repeating it. Their initial reaction is not to spell it out clearly what happened, and not worry about whose feelings might be hurt about that, just to report that the Israeli soldiers killed 60 people, most of them unarmed, and if they're armed, they had rocks or burning tires or they flew a kite. Yes, some of them went to the fence. It's not clear to me anyway exactly what happened there and whether they got through. They have in the past infiltrated, but The essence of what happened is in a column by Amira Hatz in Haaretz this morning, which is extraordinary. It's the Gaza fence that separates the brave from the cowardly. The brave being the Palestinians living in Gaza who've been in an open-air prison, which even the former Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, called it an open-air prison. They have withstood two major assaults against them in the last 10 years. There's a blockade, of course, air, land, and sea. You cannot see this other than what David Cameron thought it was. And the brave people are demonstrating anyway, knowing they will be slaughtered, knowing the hospitals cannot take care of all of them, that they've reached that point. They hope the world will notice, is what Amira Hatz writes. And there's also, of course, Gideon Levy and Haaretz. Where in the American press do we have any columnists like that? This is the Israeli press. This isn't Israel. We have two columnists regularly writing for this newspaper that say these types of things. They've gotten death threats, apparently. Gideon Levy has. But where in the American press do you see that? Instead, we have what I wrote about, which is this mealy-mouthed, passive way of describing what happened. And I pointed out my article at the beginning because it was on Twitter that I hadn't really been looking at the coverage that had immediately come out, but there were responses from Glenn Greenwald and Max Blumenthal, and quite viciously funny ones, too, actually, about how the coverage was being undertaken by the United States. For example, Max writes, he complained about a CNN headline that said dozens die in Gaza, and he responded, maybe they were old, maybe perhaps they were sick, they just up and died. Who will solve the mystery behind these deaths? And Glenn Greenwald took the New York Times to task for a headline that was, dozens of Palestinians have died. in protests as the U.S. prepares to open Jerusalem embassy. And he says that most media outlets in the West have become very skilled through years of practice of writing these kinds of headlines, describing Israeli massacres as in the passive tense to hide the culprit. But the all-time champ, he says, is the New York Times and hashtag have died. So, you know, this it had to be pointed out by them. When I saw this developing, I thought I had to write something about this to pull it together. And that's what I did.
And again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I want to also welcome to these airwaves our good friend, Ray McGovern. Ray had a little run-in during a recent hearing for the next director of Central Intelligence. Apparently, this woman, and I tend not to use her name. I just think of her as the torturer. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Flashpoints. How are you feeling? You took quite a beating there.
Thank you, Dennis. Yeah, I feel rather restrictions. This was
we're losing you on this phone.
I'm sorry. My left shoulder didn't go out, which was a very major concern. It's a separated shoulder chronically. So, yeah, I'm feeling lucky.
Yeah, ducky, huh? Why did you expect to be thrown around like that and beaten up and then held overnight and taken to central booking for this? You're gone.
No, I didn't. Like the Gazans that died in Gaza, if you saw the tape, you saw that I fell down. they threw me down on the floor after I got, you know, after they apprehended me, all four of them. Dennis, you'll appreciate this, and Joe too. You've been in New York. In my day, I would tell people you should see the other guy.
Well, we saw the other guy. We saw the other guys.
There were four
Ray.
Of them,
and we saw them keep yelling, "Stop resisting! Stop resisting!" And there were monstrosities all over you.
Yeah.
And you're saying, "Excuse me, but that's my arm," and you've moved it to the wrong place.
Yeah, but, you know, they'll say I just fell down, and just like the Gazans, they just died. And, you know, it's, I wish it were really funny. What happened today is painful, just shameful, that 10 of that committee voted to approve a torturer, a self-admitted torturer. Well, self-admitted only. My beef there at the hearing was that Ron Wyden says to her in his last question, Ms. Haspel, were you in charge, were you supervising the waterboarding of Al Nashiri in Thailand? And she says, Senator, that's classified. And I'm saying, my God, you know. And Wyden says, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. But, you know, either he or the chair, Richard Burr, should have said at that point, well, who classified that? And she would have said, well, actually, I did it. Yeah. So you've got a person who classified the incriminating evidence that shows beyond any reasonable doubt that she shouldn't be the head of the CIA, and that was let stand. So the people watching, if there were a million people watching the hearing, none of them got to know whether she really did that because it's classified by her. I mean, hello, that's when I got up and I said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Senator Wyden is entitled to a straight answer on that. You all on the panel know what the straight answer is, so of course is Ms. Haspel. So, you know, why doesn't she, then I was, then my voice was muffled by the four gentlemen that thought that I shouldn't be saying those things.
Well, what were you telling them as they were, besides the fact that they were dislocating your shoulder, you kept talking. What were you telling them?
Well, I was trying to, you know, reach the room there to say that, you know, waterboarding is torture and there's no way to make waterboarding legal. Because, you know, that's what they were all saying, you know, with orders to the Justice Department office, let's say, kind of office of whatever it is, said, oh, it's okay. That's Alberto Gonzalez, you know, Bush's lawyer. I mean, nobody thinks that torture is okay. And, you know, when Gonzalez, I followed this really closely at the time, when Gonzalez told Bush that, you know, you don't have to abide by conventions, you have power to just annul that. And so...
He was counsel to the president at the time.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So he wrote David Addington, who's more literate and just as sinister, wrote this this 7 February 2002 memorandum, which was an executive order by the president saying we don't have to abide by the Geneva Conventions, but, quote, we will treat detainees humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, period, end quote. Hello, that's not what Geneva says, and there's no provision in Geneva at all for exceptions such as those. So even Gonzalez was aware of that, and he wrote another member saying, now, there may be people in the future that will try to accuse you of violating the convention, but we have artful ways of taking care of that. It's all out there. Those memos are available. So this was a charade, and... it really bothers me greatly that Mark Warner, one of my senators here in Virginia, made a little deal so that the incriminating evidence on Gina Haspel, secret as it became since she classified it secret, was not made available to the other senators. Now, we still have to, you know, have the vote in this whole Senate. I still have this forlorn hope that there's enough decency in the American people and that they will be up in arms and go to their senators and say, my God, are you really going to approve a person who is demonstrably guilty of supervising waterboarding and destruction of evidence? My God. So we've reached quite a pass here, and I'm glad I did what I did because nobody else was calling attention to it. But of course, I didn't make the New York Times.
Well, there were many. You may not have made the New York Times, but there were many people around this country and around the world who took heart. Ray McGarvin, because I can tell you, it took me about 9 calls to track you down to find out where you were. But once I found out where you were, boy, they knew exactly who you were, and I got the royal treatment. I got more information than I ever got before in my life from a police station or central booking, because they wanted to show how, you know, they knew what was going on. You were sort of okay and blah, blah, blah. But clearly the whole world, here's where the phrase comes back and it has meaning. The whole world was watching. Ray, let me bring Joe back into the conversation. I want to guide the conversation towards Consortium News and the significance, how important it is to have alternative news sources in this day of corporate censorship. I now think of it, Joe, as the military-industrial media complex, because the media now is this integral part of the war making, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say that. And as you absolutely correctly said, we need this kind of alternative media more than ever. And they know that, the other side. They're troubled. The entire ruling class, if I could use that phrase, is nervous, and because they feel threatened by the results of the 2016 election on both right and left. There were insurgencies, and some of it is fueled by alternative media on right and left, actually. And this has to stop, because they're not getting the control that they once had, or at least they still obviously have dominant influence, the corporate media. And they shape the thinking of so many people in our country. But there are inroads being made, and they can't be tolerated. So we've seen efforts by Facebook, by Google, to de-rank various websites, to label them as being paid for by governments. Not that I saw the BBC was labeled as being paid partly by government. But
or CBC or any of the others. But, of course, the enemy is Russia, and whatever anybody says against ruling interests in the United States, corporate or political, cannot come out of our own minds and our own analysis, cannot have been in existence in our minds for decades before RT was ever even thought of. But, of course, it's because we're influenced by Russian propaganda. So that's a very convenient way to tar any kind of journalism. That's the kind we're trying to do at Consortium and that you do on your show and so many other good sites do. That's not to be tolerated because we cannot expose or at least question what government is doing in various aspects. And that used to happen with corporate media, at least for a short time, in the 70s in particular, when Bob came into journalism, and I shortly after that. We remember that period where it was the journalist's job to ask the tough questions, and there was so much more journalism, too. Many newspapers that have folded, TV stations that have been combined into these huge conglomerates now that dominate everything, and that's why these small, relatively small sites like ours need to survive and to continue to expand to challenge what government says. That's the job of journalism. It shouldn't be just left up to small websites that Bob Perry created in 1995 because he got fed up with the stories that were being spiked and now the suppression of his news. And he opened this space for other journalists who had similar experiences to come write for him. That's how I started writing 16 years after he started. And now we're in charge of this thing. It's a big responsibility, but I feel very committed, obviously, to keep doing what Bob is doing.
You're doing a good job. Now, you mentioned Amara Haas. I had a couple of chances to meet with her and be a part of various forums and stuff. But one of the things that she says, and Amira Haas reports from the West Bank, and she's taken hell. She's been, you could not count on any number of fingers the amount of death threats that she has received for her honest coverage of what happens in the occupied West Bank and in occupied Palestine. But one of the things that she said is my guiding force. And she said, our job as journalists, and I've said this before, but it means everything to me. Our job as journalists is to monitor the centers of power and report back to the people. Now, the Fourth Estate has become the First Estate. They like to sit with the power class and feel like they're a part of it.
No question about it. As I wrote in that piece you referred to at the very end, when you've been pushing the same line that's gotten you very far in the pecking order of the media business, and you've not stepped on the toes that you can't step on, you're not going to suddenly change overnight and start reporting clearly that Israel shot and killed 60 mostly unarmed people. That's just not, you're not able to do that, shift gears that quickly, because you've been used to that. That's what got you where you were. And you know what you have to do, and so you don't look at it in that way. And this is an enormous cover-up, basically, of a horrendous crime that we've seen here. And it is part of the establishment and the way that Nikki Haley at the Security Council tried to say that Israel had shown great restraint in a massacre that belongs in the annals of the massacres of colonialism, the British in India, et cetera, think something like that. That's how you have to view this. But it's just excused by a media that's supposed to report the facts. That doesn't happen.
That's the voice.
You know what I mean?
Go on, Ray.
Reminded me of the Great Salt March, you know?
Yes.
Those are people gunned down or beaten down with batons. I'd like to just very briefly interject to what we in the Bronx call a for instance. Okay, so here's a for instance. I don't have much contact with journalists, but when I did face down Rumsfeld way back in, 2006, and I showed him up to be a liar about weapons of mass destruction and ties with Al-Qaeda, I'm walking out of this think tank, and I get a call. And it's, hello, this is Anderson Cooper. Hey, Ms. McGovern, you're creating quite a stir down here. I'd like to have you in my program, but first I'd like to ask you this. And I said, sure, Anderson. Weren't you, weren't you afraid? I was in some shock at myself, and I thought that was a normal question. I said, well, no, actually, I have a brief defense. But then I said, wait a second. This is Anderson Cooper, heir to the Vanderbilt pretty boy, and I, you know, he's asking me, wasn't I? So I said, Anderson, let me just quit here.
We're losing you, Ray. Ray, can you turn your body around because we're losing your
sure,
signal.
Okay. I said, Anderson, this is a, I look at this as an incredible opportunity because here I am. I've done my homework. I know that he had to lie and answer to these questions or be asked them all, answer them all. And so, Anderson, let me give you a suggestion. Do your homework. Ask real questions, and you'll find it's a real high when you're finished.
He says, oh, well, all right, Mr. McGovern. Well, I'll have my people get in touch with your belly.
No, Anderson, no. I don't have any people. Please, just call me back. It was a bizarre. It was surreal.
I don't have any people.
Weren't you afraid? God. And this guy's not going to be out on the streets of Atlanta with his hat, right?
Listen, let me say this. I want to say this again because I have not done a due diligence to let people know that there is going to be a fantastic celebration in honor of Robert Perry. We're going to greet the new editor. Joe Laurie is going to be in town with Bob's son, Sam Perry, who is a co-founder of Consortium News. I'm going to be there. Norman Solomon's going to be there. A whole bunch of people are going to be there. We're going to be at Sita and Benita at the Favorite People's Church, the UU Universal, what... the Universal
Unitarians.
Thank you. I'm getting too old for this. But it's at Sita Bonita in Berkeley. It's on Saturday. It's at 2:00. Get there, join us. It's going to be spectacular, and I am hoping that you will pack the place to honor the work of Robert Perry, help us greet the new editor, and learn a lot about journalism as well. So I want to make sure you know this is happening this Saturday at 2:00, 2 p.m. It's at 1924 Cedar Street in Berkeley. 1924 Cedar Street in Berkeley. We want you to please join us let's share something about journalism. I love, by the way, in your piece, you include, Joe, this amazing quote from the former defense minister of Israel, Moshe Dayan. And Moshe Dayan, and you alluded to this earlier, that if you see the newspapers, if you read the newspapers in Israel, if you read Amir Ahas, you're going to learn a hell of a lot more about the nature of occupation than if you read 10 U.S. newspapers, listen to CNN and MSNBC. In fact, that would be minus learning. But this quote here is so powerful from Moshe Dayan. And he says, quote, the former defense minister in the 50s says, what cause have we to complain about their fierce, he's talking about the Gazans and the Palestinians. What cause have we to complain about their fierce hatred of us? For 8 years now, they sit in their refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we turn into our homestead, the land and villages in which they and their forefathers have lived. He went on. You say, we are a generation of settlers, and without the steel helmet and gun barrel, we shall not be able to plant a tree or build a house. Let us not be afraid to see the hatred that accompanies and consumes the lives of hundreds of thousands of Arabs who sit all around us and wait for the moment when their hands will be able to reach our blood. Wow. You're not going to read that in the New York Times, are you, Joe?
I have never read that in the New York.
I haven't seen it there. I haven't seen it in the Wall Street Journal. You wrote for them, too. Did they ever do anything like this?
No, they took out references I made to 130 countries recognizing Palestine in stories about the vote coming up at the General Assembly to make them an observer state. No, they would not put this quote in.
They censored you on those stories.
Well, it was, I would say, suppressed because...
Suppressed, okay.
Taken out before it was published.
Oh, that's right. It was an edit. Let's just say it was an edit for space.
It was an edit for space, yeah, right.
How many times have you heard that? We just need to get three lines out, and we know which ones we want.
Before the internet, it was certainly more because there really was space restrictions in a newspaper. But Moshe Dayan, by the way, Ray shouldn't get all the credit here. I'm from the Bronx, too. He was just saying.
All right. New York. All right.
But Dayan was a real tough guy. I remember growing up in the Bronx, watching him on TV, the swashbuckling, dashing defense minister of Israel with that eye patch. He was cut quite a figure in the American media at the time. He was a character. And here he is laying out the truth as he saw it. He's not mincing words at all. He's saying, don't be surprised if they're going to hate us because we're stealing their land. This is the key thing here. We've turned... Our homestead is based on their land and villages, which they and their forefathers have lived on. So all this rubbish about a people without a land, you know, people without a land, taking in a country without people, is all rubbish. And he's saying it's rubbish right there. He's saying it clearly. But he's like Benny Morris and as opposed to Ilan Popper. But they both say that there was ethnic cleansing. They list the villages that were destroyed and the enormous amount of violence that was used to clear Palestinians out. Benny Morris thinks it was good, and Ilan Pop doesn't. And that's exactly what we got here with Moshe Dayan. He's saying he agrees with it. I mean, we're a settled nation. He's not ashamed of that. This is how we're going to build Israel, and that, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of innocent victims here, and they're going to hate our guts, and we've got to be prepared for that. But, you know, he was with the project. At least he was being honest about it. And instead of this propaganda we've gotten ever since that there was, you know, Israel was innocent and they did nothing to earn the hatred of the Palestinians that exist until today, and they're still in that refugee camps in Gaza, and they're angrier than they could have been even back then, 61 years later. So how could we be surprised by the reaction, by marching to a fence, tens of thousands of people, and then to be mowed down and picked off by snipers while the American embassy is being opened in Jerusalem at the same time with a grinning Netanyahu? I mean, you can't really make this up. This is just was an extraordinary day in the history, really, of Israel.
You know, things.
Yeah, Ray.
Yeah, Joe, I agree more. And let me exercise my prerogative of being older than both of you. When I was 8 years old, right next to the war, it was the Nakba. It was the Israeli foundation of the Israel state. Now, in the Bronx, we had great rejoicing. 30% of my neighborhood were Jewish people. We were all overjoyed that Jews would have their homeland. Nobody ever told us. Nobody ever told us that there were people already there.
That there were
like
people living there.
For a millennium, right? Nobody told us that over 700,000 people driven from their homes ended up in places like Gaza. My God. And the other thing is this. When we talk about the Six-Day War in 1967, there's the USS Liberty incident, which people should really look into. But what people don't know is that a former Israeli Prime Minister, Menachem Begin, in a moment of unusual candor, during a speech, which was duly recorded by the New York Times, he said this, and it's very brief, very brief, very brief. Here it is, quote, "In June 1967, we had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations and the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him, period, end quote. So, the occupied territories are precisely that. It's been a long time since 1967. There's a UN resolution, 242, which said they should leave the occupied territories, and yet Nikki Haley and all the other people under Zionist influence act as though we're sort of a cousin of Israel and we defend it at any cost. This has got to stop, and maybe some good will come out of this massacre that happened yesterday and the day before."
All right. Listen, I appreciate both of you joining us today. Joe, I'm looking forward to meeting you in person on Saturday at 2 o'clock at the church at 1924 Cedar Street in Berkeley. Interested in what you have to say about journalism. We're going to have a celebration of alternative journalism, of real journalism. Let's call it that, of investigative reporting, which all reporting should be investigative. That's Robert Perry's motto. And again, we thank both of you for the great work that you're doing. And Ray, you're a courageous man, and the whole world appreciate. There are many of us out here who were with you. We weren't feeling the blows, but we were with you, we were watching, and we were inspired by your courage. So we appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis.
You are so welcome. Thanks to both. We'll see you. I'll see you soon, Joe.
Likewise. Thank you, Dennis. See you on Saturday.
All right. Take care. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back to you. Some of you will hear the elegant and visionary Robert Perry, and others will hear me. We have work to do. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And we're in a fun drive. And you know the work that we do here at Flashpoints. You know how much time and energy and effort we've devoted to the coverage of the most censored story in modern history, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which in the last couple of weeks has become very clear what it is. We haven't even talked about the kind of special weaponry they're using purposely. They have these 22s purposely meant. They're made in Connecticut, by the way, purposely meant to maim protesters and rock throwers forever, to maim them. They have special weaponry to tear into shreds, illegal weaponry under certain international law, to shred the people. And we have reported about that, not 1 year, not 2 years, but for the 28 years that this program has been on the air. And we will keep doing it. We don't just do it during Fun Drive, where we can offer you amazing stuff. And I do have stuff I can, you can get the complete, you can get the book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Bilan Pape, for a $100 contribution. You can get the MP3 CD Palestine pack for $75. You can get the combo, the book, and that's by Elan Pape, one of the most profound writers, Israeli writers, about the illegal occupation and ethnic cleansing. Or you can get our 70-pack, includes lectures and interviews about the history of Palestine and the occupation. It has extraordinary people, Edward Said, Elan Pape, Rashid Khalideh, Gilbert Akar. This is great stuff. I'm not going to say it a lot of times. It's a package. You can get the package for $150. I'm going to tell you this. If you have any trouble getting through it, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, then call me because I want to know. I want to know if you're not getting through. 1-800-439-5732. I should say email me at Dennis J. Bernstein at gmail.com. That's Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S-J, the letter Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, at gmail.com. If you are having any trouble getting through, hit me up with an email immediately. The phones will be answered, and we've got the web. The web is kpfa.org. You can subscribe on the web, kpfa.org. Now, we had Barbara Lubin here last night, and I think we had Diana Butu, the Palestinian lawyer who was in front of the, reporting to us about being in front of the new Israeli embassy in Jerusalem, and witnessing. She was thrown down and stuff, but she was witnessing any time. There were 300 security forces there. And anytime anybody tried to raise, just raise and free, in the free democracy of Israel, in the free democracy of Israel, anybody who tried to raise a Palestinian flag was beaten down and beaten hard. Old, young, child, old man, you name it. They were beaten down. Now, I was saying that it seems like we, you know, and I'm a little worried because we have, people don't like this, you know, there are people in power, people in the Israeli consulate hate this show. They hate me. They hate what we do here, and they have come many times to the station to complain about our biased coverage, our unfair coverage of Israel. Unfair coverage? Look at the New York Times. Look at the MSNBC, CNBC, whatever NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, whatever. The big lie. This is why they can slaughter now. This is why they feel with impunity that they can open fire on unarmed people, on women and children and journalists who are marked, and on ambulance drivers and on you name it. They could open fire, and the New York Times and the Congress of the United States will cover for them. So last night, by the way, I thought we did an amazing job. I was concerned that we literally, folks, we came out over $2,000 short on a day that I wanted to raise twice as much as what our goal was. Our goal was $3,500. We raised $1,100, and I wanted to raise $5,000. So we fell $2,500 behind. So here we are again, and I'm wondering if you will support a program that for 28 years, not just during fun drives, where we can offer you incredible stuff, but day in and day out, for 28 years, a program that brought you the truth about Palestine. That's what I am asking you to support. The information, the message. The information, the message. Believe me, when they came to shut down this radio network, the powers that be behind that, you have to understand that in part that was motivated by the work we do here. Are you kidding me? This show is unique in that way. This is a daily drumbeat show that gives a platform to Palestinians who are being ethnically cleansed. The South Africans who fought against apartheid in South Africa say it's worse than what they faced. Now, again, I've got what I think is an extraordinary thank you gift, which is you can get the MP3 CD Palestine pack for $75. You can get the Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pappe, the quintessential book on what the hell is going on there. You can get them both, that for $100, both for $150. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or on the web, kpfa.org. kpfa.org. Hit the donate button and step forward for Free Speech Radio. I'd like you, those of you who believe in the work that we do here, those of you who believe in this decision by this program to spend 28 years of drumbeat coverage on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, that you will reward us by doing something that nobody in this world makes you to do, but that your heart and your mind, your consciousness tells you how important it is in the age of Trump to support this kind of alternative, fight back, scrappy, no holes barred, free speech, truth to power radio. That's what I'm asking you to support. If this message has been important to you, then please, please, let's see if we can get you to stand up now. Right now, we got a phone number, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or at kpfa.org. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and I'm not going to give up our drumbeat coverage of Palestine. It is why this program, along with the work that we do on the Brown Revolution and on the incredible attempt to ethnic cleanse brown people from this country, this is why we were given the National Whistleblowers Award as a whistleblowing radio program from the National Whistleblowers Conference. And this was a major thing. We didn't talk much about it at the time, but we are proud to be considered the canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. And we're hoping that you will support us now, because yesterday we had a problem. and I want to make back the money and make a difference in this world. 1-800-439-5732. I would like you to send a message to the powers that be inside and outside this station that you care about this story, that you care enough about this story to put your money where your beliefs are, to stand up, to take an action that nobody makes you take, but that your mind and your heart and every cell in your body says is the right thing to do. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or go to the web. Go to the web. KPFA.org. Click on the pledge button and step forward for Free Speech Radio. Support us. Help us stand up against this big lie, this most censored story. Tell me the last time you even ever heard. Have you heard the name Amira Haas? Liberated woman, courageous woman, reporter for Haaretz in the West Bank. An amazing reporter, a feminist in the extreme. Have you ever seen her on Rachel Maddow? Have you ever seen her with Anderson? You heard what Anderson asked Ray McGovern. Why aren't you afraid? 1-800-439-5732. You can get the Ilan Pappe book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Why don't you get the book and learn in detail, precisely, specifically, what is going on? What is happening? I just lost my screen. 1-800-439-5732. I'm asking you to stand up and make a difference now. Thank you, Claude Hopkins. We appreciate your call. And thank you, Antonio Ruiz, again. We thank you for your call. Now we know the phones are working today because those two folks got through. But that's two. That's 50. We raised $50. We need you to stand up now. And, we gave out the number. And everybody knows what it's about. Everybody who cares knows what it's about. Everybody who's listened to this show knows what we're about. Maybe you already have these premiums, so we can't sell you these premiums. Maybe you just want to stand up and put your money where your beliefs are because you believe in free speech and free speech radio. And let me tell you, we can use some serious help now. Thank you, Mitch Greenberg. We appreciate your help. You're the third person who's called. We're going to need about 50 people to call. And thank you. Thank you for your generosity, Anita Burrows, a friend, a longtime friend of the show, Mom. And we wouldn't have Nora Barrows Friedman if there wasn't Anita Burrows. So thank you, Anita, for calling. But that's four people, and we need 50 people. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. How about on the web, kpfa.org? kpfa.org. Miguel, you can join in.
Dennis, it's clear. Right now there's a massive human rights crisis. There's a massacre happening as we speak in Palestine. And, we need to rise beyond the media landscape of, fake news, false news, all of that. And we're asking you, if you can, fund us outright and get the thank you gift that is us, this show, streaming through radios all over Northern California. If you're searching for that truth, then we are it. We have that truth. And if you don't need a premium, a gift, or something, we are the premium. So please support this work. In some communities, Flashpoints is viewed as Radio Palestina, Radio Free Palestine. And in the Native American communities here in California, throughout the country, the Palestinians are the Native Americans of Palestine, of occupied Palestine. We need your help. They need our help. You cover our backs and we'll give the microphone to them. You get the truth. You get the facts and honesty from the ground, from ground zero, from a Palestinian reporter. Become our ally. We need you today.
It's 1-800-439-5732. There is, by the way, thank you, Fawaz, for your generous contribution. It's 5:41 in the afternoon, 5:46 in the afternoon, and we've got five callers, and I'm going for 50. And I'm asking you to stand up and make a difference and help us make our goal and do the work that we need to do here. And we're going to need a little help from folks who have a little more if we're going to get through this one today. So if some of you couldn't get through yesterday, or you didn't have a chance, or you somehow have not stepped forward, we're asking you to step forward now and honor the work that we do here and honor our 25-year collaboration with the Middle East Children's Alliance and stand up and make a difference right now. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. If you've got a little extra, give a little extra. If you can get the book and the CD for $150, you can just give us $50 or $100 or $1,000. We don't have a matching fund. Maybe somebody out there has $500 or $1,000. We're open for business. We're open for the business of free speech radio. We're open for you to be the next caller. And I'm really asking you to do it now for us, for yourself, for the future, for the children. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or you can go to the web, kpfa.org, and pledge online, and we would be happy to get your contribution there. And I'm going to see if anybody has checked us out. kpfa.org, you can do that right now. We are asking you to step forward and make a very big difference now. We have a couple of callers that have come in on the web. We thank you for calling, but we're hoping that you will keep calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Mikhail.
And what you get here from Flashpoints is uncensored, uncompromised news and information. And we do that because of you. And that's the true thank you gift. The truest and purest way to give directly to KPFA is to support us without getting a thank you gift. But you can by donating on the website at kpfa.org. And, you know, at this point, we're in a massive fight here, not just here within the state to take back the White House, to take back this country from racist bigots and, you know, people just bent on hatred and, you know, separatism and ethnic cleansing. We see that on the borderlines here between Mexico and United States, 100 miles in, 100 miles south, where there's this massive movement and fortifying that so-called border. We see the same company building that border here at the U.S.-Mexican border, the same folks that built the walls in Palestine, around Gaza. It's the same companies, the same corporations. It's the same folks, and this president here is arm in arm with the Prime Minister of Israel. I'm not even going to mention his name because he is under, you know, federal investigation in his own country, just like this president here, for corruption and, you know, doing things that are contrary to the Constitution, contrary to the whole justice system, Department of Justice within the United States. But today, we need your support. We are taking the fight. We're out there in the front lines. You get the news. We strive to present truth, facts, and speak honestly. Now we need you to take our backs, to cover our backs. 1-800-439-5732. All of you that came up in the 50s and 60s around social justice, be it the civil rights movement or be it the farm workers movement or the women's rights movement, we're still here. And some of you that were there, we need your support. 1-800-439-5732. You hear the urgency? There's truth behind it with me and Dennis. The system here has collapsed for whatever reason, but we need you to go online right now and make sure that Flashpoints is here to be the beacon, to be the light, to be the voice for those that don't have a voice in mainstream. And right now, those voices are Palestinians. 1-800-439-5732 or go online. That's the securest way to give to Flashpoints and help Flashpoints remain here on Pacifica Network, here KPFA, and that is www.kpfa.org. Go to your online subscription now. And again, we are the premium. But if you want, you know, other things, Dennis will go into again and explain what we have to offer.
Well, we've got the Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pappe for $100. We've got the MP3 CD Palestine Pack, 70 pieces, includes lectures and interviews about history of Palestine, the occupation with the Ilan Pappe, Rashid Khaledeh, Gilbert Akar, Edward Said, and many others. And it's, let's see, we have raised about $700 at this point of our $3,500 goal today. I thank those people who have called. I really appreciate you standing up. Thank you, Maya Alashi. Thank you, Jennifer Steck, for your contributions. And we're asking you who have not done this yet, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, we're asking you to stop for a moment and think about the power of this alternative network, how important it is to have a university, an invisible university in the airwaves that can turn its spotlight on the suffering of the Palestinians and on their courage to fight back, on their courage to resist the incredible brutality that is misreported or thoroughly unreported by the mainstream press. Now, you know, it could be that you're we're up to about 11:25. It could be that you're watching the basketball game. I think the championships are on now, or they're coming up. It could be, and maybe you've chose to do that at this point. We haven't. Every day at 5 o'clock for the last 28 years, we've been here. And whenever there's an attack on Palestine, we have fought back and fought back hard. And we're asking you to help us fight back now. This is a bit of a struggle today for us. And I'll be honest with you. I am frayed because I have been working night and day, getting calls 24 hours a day with my brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine and all over this world feeding me information so that when we get more time, when we get through the fundraiser, we'll be ready to go. We're doing our best now in the context, but having to raise funds and hear about people who you know, people who you've interviewed on the phone being shot, people who you have come to really respect being beaten and brutalized and undermined, it is very hard. And I'm just here in Berkeley. Can you imagine what it's like to be treated the way the Palestinians are being treated? And then for the world, for the New York Times, talk about it as 56 people killed, not 56 people murdered by the Israelis. No, no, no. We don't do that. And we need your help to go forward. And we're having a hard time doing it today. And my heart, there is a big traffic jam between my heart and my mind because I'm thinking about all the people and all the responsibilities we have to make sure that we keep the program on and keep doing the reporting that we need to do. So if you're out there, and you really care about the work that we do here in the last 5 minutes, and you got a little extra money, or you just got $25, I'm asking you to pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.
You can do it on the web securely at kpfa.org. Do it on the web securely at kpfa.org. But whatever you do, please do it now, because we are running out of time. And, you know, you have to... People say, don't take it personally. You know, there's so many things that could be going on. But it's not that I take the not subscribing personally. What I take personally is the fact that people who are risking their lives and being shredded might not have a voice if we can't keep doing the work that we're doing here. If we lose Flashpoints, if we lose KPFA, if we lose Pacifica Radio, that's what I'm worried about. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Miguel?
Well, this is the time to take a stand. And if some of you don't remember, we took a stand against McCarthyism. The free speech movement was amplified by KPFA, the Black Panthers, the United Farm Workers, the Brown Beret, the Mechas. They articulated their visions here on this air. The sanctuary movement of the 1980s, the Iran Contra scandal, came through here on KPFA. The coverage of Occupy, Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, and the whole immigrant rights movement and their struggles has all been amplified here on the station because of you. And now we are in a battle against the supremacist White House under the leadership of the racist bigot president himself. We need you to be with us so we can be as vigilant as always. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or go to kpfa.org and pledge online. We need you now, not mañana. This is the time to do it. Take a stand with us, and we will continue the battle in the trenches for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria Ortiz. Thank you, Nolan Olhansen. We thank both of you for calling. We have about 2 minutes left, and we are really hoping that in these... What is our total now, Mike? Where are we at now? We're at 1,700. Okay, that's better than 1,000, but it's not 3,500. Anybody out there have 25 or 2,500? This would be a very cool time to give us a whole bunch of money or just a little bit of money, and we have the time to take it. If you can stand up, if you could put your money where your beliefs are, if you'll step forward, at least you could take us over the 2,000 mark. Maybe there's a couple of you out there who will take us over 2,000. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or on the web at kpfa.org. Whatever it is, whatever you got, we'll take it. We need it now. We're hoping that you will stand with us in this last minute and a half of the show. Come on, si se puede. Do it for us. Do it for yourselves. Do it for the future. 1-800-439-5732. That's right, Miguel. For the children. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis returns with more shrewd and sane insights about ending the many wars in Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. Progressive author and activist Phyllis Bennis was in New England, October 13, 2016. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston. She spoke on her area of greatest expertise and greatest concern, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Her talk was titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria, and we heard the first half of it last week. Last week, she focused on the complexity of the Syrian conflict. There's not a war in Syria, she says. There are at least a half dozen wars in Syria. Half of them proxy wars. That is, wars actually between other countries, but being fought to the last Syrian. This week, Bennis continues. She refutes some of the myths Americans believe about the Syrian wars. The myth that the U.S. is not yet one of the belligerents in this conflict. The myth that our government is united in its opposition to Syria's President Assad. The myth that, under Assad, Syria's policies have been anti-American and anti-Israel. Quite the contrary. And she refutes the myth that imposing a no-fly zone is an alternative to war. In fact, it is an escalation of war. Then Bennis shifts gears and explores the staggering financial cost of America's undeclared war in Syria. Then she moves on to four good moves the United States government could make in Syria. Each of the four is likely to produce a better result than war. None of them is very likely to happen, though, especially not in an election year. That's Bennis's talk in a nutshell. But don't settle for the shell. Let's savor the rich stuff inside. Bennis is a fine speaker, a good scholar of Middle Eastern history, and seemingly a good person. I think it was Quintilian who defined the art of rhetoric as a good man speaking well. Except for the man part, that sounds much like Phyllis Bennis. Here she is again.
Now, there's a lot of mythology about the Syrian war. One is that the problem in Syria is that the U.S. isn't doing anything. The U.S. isn't intervening, and we need U.S. intervention. Well, it's a myth on a couple of fronts. Number one, the U.S. is right in there. The U.S. is bombing in eastern Syria. It's not bombing in Aleppo right now, which is very good because it would just be killing more people than the Russians and the Syrians are killing, and that's plenty. It's way too many already. But they are bombing, supposedly, against ISIS in eastern Syria. Now, the problem is what that means is, you know, you can't bomb terrorism. You can bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you can even bomb terrorists if you get lucky. But you can't bomb terrorism. And where ISIS is, there are people living there. They are living in cities. And the people in those cities have no ability to get out. So when we hear, and we hear this a lot about, we're getting ready for the attack on Mosul, we're getting ready for the attack on Raqqa. Those are the two kind of capitals of ISIS, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. Mosul is a city that once held about 2 million people. It now has, we think, somewhere around 675,000 people that are left. They can't get out. They can't get out. So when the U.S. starts to, quote, liberate Mosul with its bombers, ISIL will be able to get out. The people who live there will not. And that's who the people will be who will die. ISIS, I'm guessing, are going to get out and they're going to scatter and we're going to be hearing from them for a very long time. The same in Raqqa inside of Syria. So one of the myths is the U.S. isn't doing anything, or it's not doing enough, where people mean militarily. The U.S. isn't doing a lot of stuff it needs to do. But the military problem is not that it's doing not enough. It's that it's doing too much of the wrong things. So that's one of the myths. There's another myth that says that everybody in the U.S. wants to, in U.S. government wants to overthrow the regime in Syria. That's a myth also. There are plenty of people in power in Washington and some who are out of power, the neoconservatives and others, who have long wanted to get rid of the regime in Syria. It's one of the seven countries that were on the famous list that surfaced in 2002 that the neocons had been distributing about the seven countries they want to overthrow. That's certainly true. The myth is that that's the only reason that there's anything bad going on in Syria. You hear this from some. Not taking into account that Syrians themselves rose up against a pretty terrible government and tried to change it. The other problem with that analysis is that it doesn't take into account the reality of what the government in Syria has been about. There, one of the other myths is that the government in Syria, the Assad family, father and son, who've been in power since 1970, that they represent some kind of a center of resistance, an arc of resistance in the Middle East, that they are against the West, they're against Israel, they support the Palestinians, they're the real upholders of Arab nationalism. Well, it turns out, when you look at the history, not so much. It doesn't work that way so much. So you can start in from the time of the 1967, even before the Assad came to power, but certainly from then, Israel is occupying the Syrian Golan Heights, right? And the Syrian governments have made sure that the population was relatively quiescent, that the border stayed relatively quiet. Once in a while, there'd be a bit of a border skirmish, but those border skirmishes never really resulted in full-scale war. Fast forward to 1976, the Syrian regime, in support of a right-wing Israeli-backed militia in Lebanon, launch a massive attack against the Palestinian refugee camp at Tel Azatar, killing a huge number of Palestinians. So this notion that they're all in the interest of Israel. So this notion that they're against Israel and supporting the Palestinians kind of falls by the wayside. 1990, the U.S. is running around, President Bush the first, trying to get support for the first attack on Iraq, right? Operation Desert Storm. They want a coalition that includes Arabs to give them credibility. So they go to Damascus and say, will you join our coalition? And the answer is, sure, no problem. So Syrian jets, Syrian Air Force fighter jets, fighter bombers are sent to participate in the U.S. coalition bombing Iraq in 1991. 2003, in the global war on terror, the U.S. goes to Syria and says, can we outsource interrogation to you for detainees that we're picking up in the global war on terror? You're so good at interrogation. And the Syrians say, sure, why not? So one of those people is the Canadian citizen Maher Arar, who's arrested at Kennedy Airport, interrogated for 3 weeks by U.S. and Canadian officials. They think he's a terrorist. He can't confess to anything because, what a surprise, he doesn't have anything to confess to. But instead of sending him home, they ship him off to Syria, where he is held for almost a year in a dungeon, a coffin-sized dungeon, and tortured for almost a year. The Syrians can't get him to confess to anything because, what a surprise, he's got nothing to confess to. He's finally sent back to Canada. The Canadians launch a big investigation to figure out maybe they did something wrong, and they determine, as a matter of fact, we did do something wrong. We identified the wrong person. He is absolutely exonerated. He is guilty of nothing. He is innocent, and they gave him $10 million in compensation for what he had suffered. The U.S. response, to this day, he is still on the no-entry list for the United States. My institute gave him one of our human rights awards, along with his lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, back in 2006. And he couldn't come to Washington to accept the award. He had to do it by video because he's not allowed into the United States. That's the kinds of failures that are endemic to this so-called global war on terror. So what we're looking at now is a series of failures all around the region, calls to replicate some of those same failures. We're now hearing an escalating call for a no-fly zone in Syria. I always want to ask Secretary Clinton when she talks about it at the debates, so do you think that Secretary Gates was wrong when he said the first thing you have to do is go to war? Or are you saying you're fine with going to war explicitly against Syria, and now that means against Russia? Are you being really reckless, or do you really think he was wrong about this? You know, the problem is, there's another myth, that a no-fly zone sounds great. We need a no-fly zone where nobody is flying and nobody is dropping bombs. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one side imposing a no-fly zone on the other and imposing it by bombing the planes or whatever that try to take off, who knows what. So it's a huge problem. It's not going to work. It's going to make everything worse. But it sounds like something you do by declaration. You know, you do it instead of bombing. Yay, a no-fly zone. Except that's not the military reality on the ground. So that's what we're facing. Now, I want to just talk about two more quick things and then open it up for discussion and whatever. The first is about the question of the domestic cost. You know, this is not only about how these things come back in what the CIA calls blowback, when an operation ends up biting you. You know, you get the consequences of it. One of the consequences of our global war on terror is that the U.S. is resented and hated in countries around the world for our bombing and killing people in those countries, for overthrowing governments that may have been very unpopular, but that local people don't necessarily think we should have had the right to overthrow, for all kinds of things. But there's also a very immediate economic cost. The current global war on terror, what President Obama calls the overseas contingency operation, is not nearly as expensive as the Iraq war under George Bush. That's true. We don't have 150,000 troops and another 100,000 U.S. contractors operating in Iraq, occupying the whole country. We have special forces, we have bombers, we have drones, we have all kinds of things. We don't have that. So the cost is not quite as much. But it's not chump change either. So when you think about this war that was started in 2014 against ISIS, that budget is kept completely separate from the Pentagon budget. You know, the Pentagon budget is its own thing. So the budget just for the war, just here in Massachusetts from 2014, you all, you taxpayers here, are paying $19,956 an hour, 24/7, for just that war against ISIS. And you've been paying it since August of 2014. That's a lot of money. Now, if you look at the Pentagon budget, the budget that doesn't include the war, doesn't include the nuclear weapons, they're in the Energy Department, doesn't include caring for veterans, only includes kind of keeping on the lights at the Pentagon, you know, keeping them in their bases around the world. Massachusetts taxpayers just this year are paying over $17 billion for that budget, for the Pentagon budget. Now, a billion, you know, you could say a gazillion and it would mean the same thing. I don't think anybody – are any of you math majors? No, okay. I'm not even sure if you were a math major you would know, but I certainly never really understood what – you know, what a billion is, or even a million. I will tell you one story. When I was, I think, in second or third grade, I had a teacher who came in one day with this giant piece of graph paper. You know, the kind with the really tiny squares that are like 10 to the inch. And she put it up on the board, and it went like through the whole blackboard. And she said, "All right, you kids, I want you to look at this, because all your life, you're going to grow up hearing about a million this and a million that, and you're never going to have seen a million anything. So here you are. This is a million little squares. Look at it and remember, that's how many there are." And there were a ton of them. And that was a million, not a billion. We're talking billions here. So imagine. But even my little square analogy doesn't really say what it is. So here's a couple of trade-offs. If you were not spending that money on the Pentagon, here's what you could do with that same $17 billion. You could pay for 171,450 elementary school teachers for a year. You could provide 231,333 clean energy jobs. What would that do to the unemployment rate here in Massachusetts? You could get 1.6 million kids into Head Start, or you could provide health care to 4.6 million children. Now, you don't have to worry about kids having health care because you live in a state that actually provides health care. What a concept. Maybe I should move here. But in general, you get the idea of what that money could be used for. What's going to keep us safer? Jobs and health and education, or more money for the Pentagon? You know, this is a huge problem. So the last thing I want to say, and then we'll open it up, is about what we can do instead. You know, it's fine to say the military stuff doesn't work. What do we do instead? So there's a few answers. None of them are easy. None of them are guaranteed to work right away. None of them will work in the short term. We know that. We also know that the military stuff doesn't work in the short term. So we have to keep that in mind. And only one of the four has any chance of being implemented in the near term. Having said that, I will tell you what the four things are. There's more, but this is a start. Number one, start with what every medical student learns on her first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. You know, they're taught when you have a patient, whatever else you do, don't make them sicker. If your goal is to stop ISIS or the Assad regime or Russia or whoever from killing people in Syria, stop killing people in Syria yourself. Pull out the troops, pull out the special forces, ground the bombers, bring them home, stop the military stuff. It's not doing anybody any good. It's making things worse and not better. You claim there's no boots on the ground, make it real. Get them out. And the sneakers, too, from the CIA and special forces. I don't think they wear boots. Number two, stop sending weapons to everybody and their brother who says they're fighting against ISIS or fighting against Assad or fighting whoever. This is the hardest one of all. Why? Because of the power of the military construct in this country. The people who make the bombs and build the planes and make the profits off of it, they're making a killing. So when you hear people say, well, no one wants this war, it's really not true. Most of us don't want this war. But there's a few people, very powerful people, who do. They're the ones who are making a profit off of it, who are selling the bombs and the planes and everything else to the Saudis and the Turks and the Jordanians and the Qataris and the UAE and everybody else, and sending them directly here, too. It's not working. They all end up in the hands of the most extreme elements. So all this talk about, well, we're only sending it to the vetted, moderate, secular ones, you know, yeah, right, until they get run over by ISIS or whoever. Just stop doing that and move towards a full arms embargo. If we're serious about wanting the other side to stop arming the Syrian regime, for instance, you know, you hear U.S. officials saying, well, Russia and Iran must stop arming the Assad regime. Well, I agree with that. It's a terrible regime. They should stop arming them. But why do we think we have any credibility at all when we're sending arms to everybody else that's trying to overthrow the Assad regime? Who would listen to that? So it's got to be an arms embargo on all sides, and we can start that by stopping the arms shipments that's going to the rebels. Some of that's beginning to be talked about a little bit in the new pressure on Saudi Arabia that's happening in Washington. You know, the U.S. has sent, just under President Obama, $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and they're using it illegally in Yemen and sending it off to be used illegally in Syria. This is a mess. Number three, we need new diplomacy, real diplomacy, and it's not going to be easy. Maybe something will happen on Saturday when there's this new diplomatic meeting that Secretary Kerry has called together. I'm not terribly optimistic, but that's worth hoping for at least. But we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war and not just aimed at being more efficient in the bombing, which was one of the big problems in that last U.S.-Russia agreement that collapsed after about a week. It wasn't aimed at stopping the war. It was aimed at dividing one group of rebels from another so the U.S. and the Russians could go in together and bomb everybody. They want to bomb ISIS. They want to bomb al-Qaeda, but they don't want to bomb the others. You know, this is not going to work. You can't have diplomacy that's aimed at better bombing and think that's going to lead to an end to the war. So we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war. The fourth, and the only one that I think we might have a chance of getting somewhere soon, has to do with the humanitarian crisis. You all know some of the statistics. Half the population of Syria has been displaced from their homes in the last 5 years. 10 million of them. It's a number that's just staggering. Half, meaning it's actually a little more than half, about 6 million are displaced within Syria. 5.5 million or so are refugees outside of Syria, overwhelmingly in the countries surrounding Syria. There is a huge refugee crisis in places like Lebanon, where now one out of every three or four people in the country is a Syrian refugee. One quarter to one third of the population in the country. It's as if 150 million Canadians were somehow dropped in our shores with nothing but the shirt on their back, no food, no water, no education plans for their kids, no job, no nothing, and we suddenly are responsible for taking care of them. You know, that's the crisis in Lebanon. In Jordan, a country that doesn't have sufficient water for its own population, is now dealing with over 1 million Syrian refugees. This is a refugee crisis. Here, we don't have a refugee crisis here. We have a racism crisis here. that's prohibiting more refugees from coming. And I've got to say, one of the outrages right now is to hear our government officials bragging, proud of our taking 10,000, a measly 10,000 refugees over an entire year, who have all spent about 2 years being vetted and another year before that in a refugee camp being vetted by the UN before they even get to the vetting process that we impose. And 78% of them are women and children. And they're still taking 2 years or so to be vetted by the U.S. And we're proud of that? Germany last summer was taking twice that daily. And we're proud of taking 10,000 in a year. So we need a real campaign here to say we want Syrian refugees. Not because, well, don't worry, we'll make sure that it's only the good guys and we'll make sure they're safe. You know, it's because we want to welcome them. We're a country that claims to be based on refugees. You know, the give us your tired, your poor, unless they're Muslim or Arab. It's shocking. It's not maybe surprising, but it's shocking that our attitude has turned into such xenophobia and Islamophobia that's so bound up with this anti-refugee position. So we need a campaign to build support for refugees and build support for ending the war, not winning the war. Nobody's going to win this war. But we need a campaign that says we've got to end it. That means an arms embargo. Doesn't happen soon, but we've got to start talking about it, so eventually it will. Thank you.
On New World Notes, we've been listening to Phyllis Bennis speaking in Boston on ending the many wars in Syria. Thanks again to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio, who made the original recording. I have edited out a stumble or two. The talk you heard was otherwise uncut. A few words from me, if you will forbear. 2016 is an election year, you may have noticed. And in this election year, as almost always, the two major party candidates have been trying to outdo each other in saber-rattling, in worship of soldiers and veterans, and in promises to further increase the already obscenely high levels of spending on the U.S. military machine. The United States has been at war in the Third World continuously for, I think, every day of my life. And I am 66 years old. Sometimes it's a big-ish war, as in Korea and later Vietnam. Sometimes it's been small wars, often three or four of them at once, such as now. In non-military terms, every war we have waged has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. Even in military terms, every war has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. With one military exception. One war was a good military success. That was our war against our evil enemy, Grenada. Our mighty, implacable, evil enemy, Grenada. Our proudest victory since VJ Day. October 25, 1983, our glorious war began. I will leave it to you to find Grenada on the map. If your eyesight is good enough and you have enough time, you probably can. But let us speak only of recent years. The U.S. invasion and bombing of Afghanistan, then Iraq, then Libya, proved three consecutive unmitigated disasters. Ongoing unmitigated disasters. Disasters not only to the poor people living there, but also to the world at large, including to the United States of America. So now, the war hawks are all shrieking to do it again in Syria. A long-standing, card-carrying, vociferous leader of the war hawks is our former senator and former Secretary of State, Hillary R. Clinton. Her Republican opponent has been a little less bellicose, particularly in matters involving Russia, which would include Syria. But Mr. Trump, too, is far more hawk than dove. That's how we used to talk back in the 60s, hawks versus doves. Either way, no matter who wins, we can expect 4 more years of bloody warfare, leaving the world a more miserable and more dangerous place than it had been beforehand. Which is quite an achievement. And good news for Lockheed Martin, as Bennis reminds us. As we're promoting regime change by bombing Damascus, will any of us reflect upon the disasters that followed this very same action we committed upon Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan? Probably not. The late Gore Vidal used to refer to this country as the United States of Amnesia. From darkest Connecticut, if memory serves, this is Kenneth Doust for New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. And speaking of amnesia, let's go out with a little music, an oldie by Midnight Oil. Illegitimi non-carborundum and ciao.
Shot memory. Plantation in Virginia. The Raj in British India. The deadline in South Africa. Shot memory. The story of El Salvador. The silence of Hiroshima. Destruction of Cambodia. Shot memory. Running water specially bought, shot memory. A smallish man, Afghanistan. A watchdog in a nervous land. They're only there to lend a hand, shot memory. The friendly five, a dusty smile. Wake up in sweat at dead at night. And in the tent you rise, hey, shot memory.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 4th, 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Joining me today in the studio is Carl Seeger Henry to discuss the Martin Luther King assassination, the media cover-up surrounding it, and the 1999 trial that proved that James Earl Ray didn't do it and that it was, yes, actually a conspiracy involving the FBI, the U.S. military, the Memphis police, local citizens, and the mafia. We'll also be discussing the latest book by attorney William Pepper on the assassination of Martin Luther King called The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which came out in 2016. But first, let me tell you about Carl Seeger Henry. He's a former English teacher and a lifelong musician, a researcher, and an activist. And it's a real pleasure to have him on the show today. Carl Seeger Henry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cheryl. Always a pleasure to join you here in the beautiful environs of WWUH Radio.
Yes, well, great. I'm glad to have you here. So, April 4th, 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. So today on the show, we're going to be discussing that a little bit and why you don't know about the trial that happened in 1999 that proved that everything we've been told about his assassination is a lie. So I'm going to start by reading a poem by author William Pepper, who wrote the book, The Plot to Kill King. And he also wrote the book, An Act of State, which is about that 1999 trial. Here's the poem, and it's at the head of the chapter called Disinformation. Truth smothered with lies suffocates and dies. In our midst, injustice reigns. And despite our plea, liberty wanes. Ignorance abounds throughout the land, programmed well by a hidden hand. But a glimmer survives, a forlorn light, to harbor truth in darkest night.
That's some poem there, Cheryl. That's well put, and I think it's exactly right on. I think in addition to that quote, I would like to offer a quote from then CIA Director William Casey, who in February of 1981 had a meeting with the new secretaries, the cabinet secretaries in the Ronald Reagan administration, and he had the duty, I guess, and the obligation to tell them, and I'm quoting, that we'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false.
Yes.
End quote. And I think that's certainly the case, frankly, of all the assassinations that have plagued us through the years, and events such as 9/11 and many, many more.
Of the other false flag events. I agree with you. I think we're there.
Except for the people like us that kind of look for alternative viewpoints and do some study, if they're getting the information from their corporate media, it's virtually all false.
I agree. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Operation Mockingbird for the listeners who may not know about that and how that has affected our media.
Excellent point, Cheryl. I think that Operation Mockingbird, number one, it's really good because folks can go online and actually read the CIA Operation Mockingbird so that they can actually see the depth of the entire operation. Essentially, what happened was it was started around 1948. It kind of gained steam through the 50s and kind of reached its zenith when the JFK assassination happened and the media was set up to give us nothing but the official story. Operation Mockingbird seeks to control the message going out to the American people by influencing and virtually infiltrating all the major corporate media outlets. So that a high 90%, 99%, 98% of every place that people get their news is from corporate media, and Operation Mockingbird ensures that they're getting the right message.
So kind of along those same lines, Carl, with Operation Mockingbird, I'm going to read something from Pepper's book again in this same chapter called Disinformation, where he talks about the media and how they just didn't cover any of the trial.
And he says, as I noted earlier, in the 37 years I have been involved with this case, there has been one effort after another to disinform the public about what really happened. Though uniformly this has involved collaboration between the government and the mainstream media, those activities have taken on a number of forms. Books and articles have been written at various stages. Television documentaries have been produced and shown repeatedly by mainstream media. Radio and television interviews have been aired, focusing on the official story. In contrast, our work was suppressed. For example, there was the use of blackouts or mainstream news embargoes of events associated with our work, such as the 1999 civil trial of the King family versus Jowers. Another such example was the failure of my first two books on the case, Orders to Kill in 1995 and An Act of State in 2003, to be reviewed by the mainstream media. The 1995 book was almost reviewed in the New York Times, whose chief reviewer told the publisher's representative that he was ordered by his editor for the first time in 27 years to pull the review. And then he goes on here, he talks about Bill Atwood at the Look magazine wanted to publish a story about it, and he was visited by Avril Harriman, former governor of New York and senior wise man of the Democratic Party, who carried greetings from the president and requested a favor. And the favor was that Look magazine would never publish anything that William Pepper wrote. And then Bill said he told them that he was going to meet with Pepper, and if he liked what he heard and saw, he was going to publish it. And then shortly thereafter, Bill Atwood had a heart attack and left the magazine. And Chandler Brosser, the associate working director who set up the meeting between Atwood and Pepper, was let go, and the article never ran. So you can see how they cover it up and how even the president is sending a message to the paper not to run something. So censorship is alive and well in America.
I think one of the things you mentioned was the 1999 trial of Lloyd Jowers. I think that's one of the most critical points that Americans should know about and don't know about. And the fact that they don't know about, to me and to anyone looking at any kind of obvious logic, is absolute proof of the total control that Operation Mockingbird has on the media. The plot to kill King described the trial that took place in 1999. The King family took Jowers to court. It was a civil action. They sued him for $100, which basically just covered King's burial fees. And they wanted to get on record some of the information that was known on the streets of Memphis but has never been publicized by our media. Lloyd Jowers owned a kind of a sleazy bar across the street from the Lorraine Motel. The Lorraine Motel was the scene of King's assassination that the official story said that the lone crazed assassin, James Earl Ray, was able to shoot him on that balcony of that hotel. Well, across the street from the hotel was the Lloyd Jowers bar. He was using the back room as a meeting place for the true conspirators of that assassination. The trial took 30 days. There were 70 witnesses drawn, and the jury took an hour to find a verdict. They decided for the Martin Luther King family and against Lloyd Jowers. But the really interesting thing about the verdict, it was a written verdict, and in the written verdict, they said that, number one, they exonerated James Earl Ray as the assassin, and they also said that all the evidence showed that the assassination was a conspiracy, and it was pulled off by the CIA, the FBI, state and city police, some members of the military, and some mobsters. Now, that's the reason that, of course, the kibosh has been put on that trial. When you think about it, this is the wrongful death trial of someone that we have a national holiday named for. How in the world could nobody in America know about this trial unless there was an absolute blanket cover-up of the entire event?
And I hate to use the word, but it's a conspiracy to cover it up.
It's a full-blown conspiracy to cover it up, exactly.
Right. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit, I'm glad you brought that up, I want to talk a little bit about James Earl Ray's history. And according to William Pepper, the conspirators started in 1966 to plan the assassination of Martin Luther King, and it included J. Edgar Hoover at the time, and he had someone working for him named Tolson, who I think he was also having a relationship with. But this guy would go to Memphis and work with these people, and he was working with people that were in the mob and also in the Klan, and they were also in the Masons, and they were this tight group in the city. It worked with the local police and fire department. People were involved. And in fact, the actual shooter of Martin Luther King was a guy named Frank Strausser, who was a police officer in the city. So James Earl Ray was already in prison for something, and they were looking for a patsy, so they went to the Missouri prison system, and they asked them if there was a guy that they could help escape who could serve good as a patsy, like he would follow orders and do what they said. So they came up with James Earl Ray, and they arranged it so he could escape. So he escapes from prison. I mean, they planned this in advance. So this is all, they wanted him to be the patsy for Martin Luther King.
Exactly. This was not just a spur-of-the-moment activity. It was well planned out.
Right. And so James Earl Ray goes to Canada, where he meets this guy, Raoul, who then follows him and takes him. They were going to actually do the assassination in Los Angeles at first, but they decided against it because they didn't want two assassinations in the same state, and they had killed Bobby Kennedy in California. So then they moved it to Memphis. And they also went to the military and asked them to come up with a sniper team. In case Frank Strausser's bullet didn't do the job, they had snipers on the building rooftops across the street ready to take him out in case that failed.
Just in case.
And so they had four of them. And actually, after the assassination, several of them fled to Mexico because they were afraid for their own lives because they knew about all of this. So James Earl Ray is then framed for this, and he's told to buy a gun, and he goes and he buys the wrong gun, and the guy makes him go back and buy a gun that they could say was used in the assassination. So he was really set up. And on the day of the actual assassination, he was told to go to the movies, but he had a flat tire or something, so he wound up going to a garage. And so he was busy doing all this. He was nowhere near the assassination site. And of course, then he's framed and put in jail for this. So anyway, I just want people to know that this was totally plotted and planned by, you know, local police, the FBI, who knows how far up in the government that went,
right,
working with the mafia. So this is not a simple matter. And what really annoys me is every January, they celebrate the birth of Martin Luther King.
Yes.
You know, all our public officials get up there and they say all these great things, but nobody ever talks about this. Nobody, they probably don't even know about this.
They probably don't even know about it.
And if they can do this with Martin Luther King, we know there's a lot of evidence that the Kennedy assassination isn't what they told us, right?
Right.
And then if you look at how they've covered up 9/11, and I would say very sloppily, actually, this changed our system. If they get away with this, they're going to keep doing it. And that's why I think it's really important for Americans to look at this, to know what really happened, because if they keep getting away with this, they're going to keep doing it.
Exactly. I think there are areas of encouragement for us, and probably the biggest boon to the expression of truth is the internet, because all of a sudden now we have a wealth of information available. We can see various opinions. We're not just tied to the Operation Mockingbird control corporate media, because they are certainly never going to speak of this. This will never appear anyway, anywhere in their broadcast on Martin Luther King Day. And it's, you know, it's heartbreaking. I go on a media blackout on Martin Luther King Day because I can't stand watching the media not talk about what really happened. It's infuriating, it's disappointing, and it's just so important that the American people know what's going on, because so far we don't know. But more and more people are becoming enlightened, and it's kind of encouraging because you see this awakening happening really across our country and across the world.
And I think the elite are really afraid of this because they are really cracking down on they're removing websites. They have Facebook and Twitter and Google. You have Congress telling them. You know, Congress members have a meeting with them telling them to censor more. I mean, what's that all about?
I know.
And they're doing it. And I know after the Mandalay Bay event in Las Vegas, so many people now are aware of this that all the eyewitnesses were putting up videos and talking about how there was more than one shooter. And they kind of couldn't control that.
Exactly.
So then with the latest Parkland, Florida one, you don't see half of that. They are really taking everything down before it can get up there. So our ability to learn about what's really going on is being threatened. And people should be really aware of that. I do want to just continue a little bit with James Earl Ray, because he was totally innocent, and William Pepper got involved in the trial and interviewed him in prison and was convinced that he was innocent, and that later came out and was proven with all these details. But he also had liver disease, and William Pepper had arranged for him to have a liver transplant in Pennsylvania. The doctor was ready to do it, and the prison system wouldn't let him go and do it, and that was basically a death sentence for him. And he actually died before the trials, but he was exonerated. I also wanted to talk about Dr. William Pepper, this attorney who has done these 37 years plus of research into this. And if it weren't for him, none of this information would be out there. We wouldn't have had the trial. So we really owe him a great debt to truth and transparency. And he actually, when he started doing this, he actually had death threats and had to move his family to England in 1981, and he would travel back and forth to do his work on the case. But he had young children, and they were getting threatening phone calls to the kids when they answered the phone. So he moved his family there for safety. So that just shows how undemocratic our country is if you can't be looking into these things without getting death threats.
I think William Pepper will go down when all of this boils over and comes out as really one of the greatest heroes in American history. As a matter of fact, I have a fantasy about a new Mount Rushmore. And on the new Mount Rushmore, we have the unbelievably courageous people that have gone up against scorn, ridicule, sometimes physical threats, health threats. They've had their families harassed. And so many people in the entire truth movement really have taken very courageous steps to speak the truth. And on my new Mount Rushmore, certainly William Pepper's profile would be up there. I would also put Richard Gage, who was a founder of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, up on that mountainside. And Cheryl, I guess I'd have to put you up there too.
Oh wow!
At least on the little Connecticut molehill.
Exactly. We'll
have our Connecticut heroes that have really spent their life getting at and trying to encourage truth and freedom in our country.
Thank you. I consider that a real honor, and I like that idea though of a new Mount Rushmore.
Wouldn't that be great? Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, you'd be on the Connecticut molehill.
Well, I would put you there too, Carl, because you've done a lot of work, and you go on certain radio stations and tell the truth on a variety of topics, and I really appreciate that. Okay, maybe you could tell us a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I've kind of been billed as controversial Carl, and I go on to several broadcasts, and I try to talk about whatever topic is hot. Sometimes it pertains to what's happening as far as the calendar goes. For instance, on Martin Luther King Day, I'm always trying to speak about the trial of Lloyd Jowers. I discuss 9/11 truth, geoengineering, which is weather modification, and chemtrails, and just generally Operation Mockingbird and how important it is for other voices to be heard to let our population be educated to alternative viewpoints.
Yeah, and that's really great. And I'm actually surprised that you get these invitations, but I'm really thrilled that you do. And you do a great job. So
thank you very much.
Yeah. And when I say I'm surprised, it's because these are the more mainstream outlets, more corporately controlled. That's why I'm surprised that they're inviting you on. I also wanted to talk a little bit about Jesse Jackson, because in this book, The Plot to Kill King by Dr. William Pepper, he says that Jesse Jackson actually was an FBI informant. And on the day of the assassination, Jesse Jackson was the one, there was a band in the that was following Martin Luther King that was called the Invaders, and they were in the Lorraine Motel, and Jesse Jackson was the one who went in and told them that the Southern Christian Leadership Council, the SCLC, was paying for this, and he told them they were no longer going to be paying for them and that they had to leave immediately. So he got them out of the hotel before the assassination happened.
Right.
So if you think about that, you know, they do reward people who work with them. If you see how Jesse Jackson has risen in he has national notoriety, et cetera.
Yeah, how much publicity has Jesse Jackson gotten over the years? And he's kind of been billed as a hero to Black America, you know, and in many cases, when you look at the history of the entire King assassination, he's anything but a hero. He was instrumental in helping pull the entire affair off.
You know, on this 50th anniversary of his assassination of Martin Luther King, I wish people would really reflect on what we lost in all of those assassinations in the 60s. You know, what we lost, because these were people talking about they were against the Vietnam War, Kennedy and Martin Luther King, against big business. I mean, wanting for people truth and justice and economic stability for people.
Exactly.
And we lost all of that. And who is going to then take the leadership role when they see what happens if you do?
It's a very disquieting circumstance when everyone is discouraged because they seem to think it's impossible to buck. However, you know, the internet is here and people are awakening. I think there's a grand awakening happening across our country.
Right.
I do a lot of research into some of the events that are going on now, and it's absolutely stunning to me how many more people are involved in all of these events. I think one of the most encouraging things is I just did a book review of a teenage novel called Truthers. And this novel, the protagonist is a 16-year-old girl. And in the process of doing this review, apparently a lot of the young kids, they are really conspiracy nuts. They don't get their information from corporate media. They get all of their information online, which means they're exposed to all of these alternative viewpoints. And that means, of course, that they can look at what seems to make sense, what seems to be logical, and what seems to fit a pattern. And they don't care what the establishment is telling them they have to believe, they're willing to make their own judgments.
Right. And I actually interviewed Jeffrey Gerard about that book, and he said his students, that's what they want to know. They want to know the conspiracy stuff. Like these kids, once you go online or wherever your sources are, I like reading books, too. I think those are great sources, but you have to know which books to get.
Exactly.
Because you don't want to read the CIA-promoted books like Gerald Posner or somebody like that. But once you know how it works, once you get how you're lied to, then they can't really lie to you so much anymore because you're kind of aware of it, you know. So it's really important to develop that sort of media savvy, I would have to say.
It really is. I know a lot of times, for instance, I subscribe to the Hartford Courant, which I describe as America's oldest continuously published fake newspaper. And it's just astonishing how they slant the news. Much of their content is reprinted from the Washington Post, which, of course, has been totally supported by the CIA through the last 20 years or so. And all they get right now, everything is, it's just unbelievably anti-Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 99.9% Trump is a lunatic, Trump is this, Trump's that. And they're just doing everything possible to turn, in the case of the Courant, the people in Connecticut's mind and opinions against Donald Trump. So it's, you can see how they set up their stories. You can see how they frame their arguments. You look at their editorial cartoons. You look at their letters to the mm-hmm. editor. And virtually none of them are pro-Trump. They're,
right.
they're
and
all
I,
against Trump.
And I'm not a big Trump supporter, but I do think that the media has gone over the top with it. And it looks like, you know, they're all on the same page, all
they're
the corporate
all on
media.
The same page.
And, you know, become very politicized rather than just telling us facts and truth. So it is discouraging to see that.
Well, I think if you're going to have any convictions pro-Trump, one of the main reasons you may want to do that is simply because everybody that we know that are people that are not truthful are against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mass of the corporate media do everything possible to make him look as bad as possible. And, you know, that well, to me says something right, there. There's got to be something going on.
Yeah, I agree. That makes sense. And one thing I do appreciate about Trump is that he calls them fake news. And he's not afraid to say that. And that, you know, in spite of all the other things I don't like about him, I really do appreciate mm-hmm. that he does that. But, you know, none of our presidents have been so wonderful in the last, since the Kennedy assassination. They've all been puppets, really. And Trump may not be a puppet. I mean, I don't like a lot of his politics, but he's not. Doesn't seem to be a puppet. I don't know.
He certainly doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be a puppet, if only because mm-hmm. everybody in the media is against him.
Right.
And
right.
That I think that says a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, Carl, I know you have written a song about 9/11 called Building 7, The Smoking Gun. And I know now you're interested in doing something with the Martin Luther King assassination, some kind of music. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Because there's been such a dearth of information on the trial of Lloyd Jowers, and because it's such a revelation for people that actually finally hear about it, I think it would be a great topic for a song to cover what happened with this trial and how it affects America. And I also think that the best way to do it is to present it in a jazz idiom for a couple of reasons. Number one, jazz is much more of a subculture in American pop music. There are stations like University of Hartford that play a lot of jazz material. And these stations are not necessarily the big commercial corporate stations, but largely they're smaller independent stations, they're college stations. So there is a way, there is at least a means to get a song like this, because it's a jazz tune, out over the airways and reach other people. I've done some outreach to various jazz societies and jazz musical groups to let them know that I think this song would be a tremendous topic. One of the most important songs that was recorded in the last century was a song called Strange Fruit. The hit was recorded by Billie Holiday, and it was put out in 1939. Strange Fruit was an extremely controversial song when it came out. The Strange Fruit represents the bodies of African Americans as they're hung from the trees during lynchings.
Mm.
And the arrangement and the lyric just stunned America when it came out. In fact, let me give you a couple of the lines from the song. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves, blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. So for Billie Holiday to sing this took tremendous courage. And I think the topic of the trial of Lloyd Jowers is every bit as important as Strange Fruit. In this case, for this century, it could be that important, that iconic, that strong of an emotional song. So if there's any jazz musicians out there that might consider doing this, boy, I'd love to talk with them about it. I can certainly provide, at the very least, lyrical content or lyrical help. and this would be a great story to get out. I think the proper jazz arrangements of a song as this, once people hear it, they would be blown away. And it's a topic unlike any other topic mm-hmm. they could sing about.
So if anyone is interested in working with you on that and collaborating with you on that, how can they reach you?
The best way to reach me is either by telephone at 860-515-3343, or you can email me at JP Carl Henry. That's like Justice of the Peace, Carl with a C, Henry, JP Carl Henry at cox.net. And musicians, I'd love to talk with you about it. Let's explore the possibilities. It could be a song that could shape a generation.
Yeah, and Carl is a great musician, so working with him will be a joy for you. So please give him a call or an email. Carl, just wrapping this up, I want to talk a bit more about The Plot to Kill King, the truth behind the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. by Dr. William Pepper. I encourage every American to get this book and read it. Ask your library to carry it and get it from them, because every library should have this. And take a copy of this book to the January Martin Luther King celebrations and kind of speak truth to these people. People need to know this. And I just wanted to talk about, before Martin Luther King was shot, he was at the Lorraine Motel. He was shot at about 6:01 p.m. on April 4th of 1968. It was reported by hospital employees that there were a lot of military intelligence men arriving at the hospital before he was shot. And then it was arranged ahead of time that he would go to St. Joseph's Hospital, because the head surgeon there was with these conspirators and wasn't going to let Martin Luther King leave alive if the shot didn't kill him. So Martin Luther King is taken to the hospital with all these military intelligence people around. The emergency room people did a tracheotomy on him because he was shot in the chin and it went through his neck. And then this lead surgeon comes in, and his name was Breen Brand, Dr. Breen Brand. And he came in and he told everyone to get out, and he said something to the effect of, "Let this nigger die." And then they did no more procedures on him. And it was also reported by a nurse there that that same doctor took a pillow and actually smothered Martin Luther King, because he didn't die from the shot. Now, he probably would have eventually, but they smothered him to death. And people should know this. What we've been told is totally fabricated, totally false. And the fact that the media hasn't told you any of this trial or any of the information in this new book is just incredible to me. I mean, this is, you know, a guy, as you said, we honor yearly as a great American, and nobody is talking about this. And that kind of, as you said, just sheds a little bit of light on just how controlled and censored our media is. And if
exactly.
you think you're getting the truth on anything, you're not. As with 9/11, as with a lot of the recent attacks around America and in Europe, you're not getting the truth about those. And so we hope you'll do a little bit of research. And Carl, maybe you could tell the people, what are some of your favorite websites to go to for some alternative media? One of my favorite websites is globalresearch.ca for a kind of geopolitical look at things. I also really like Sibel Edmonds, her website, which is now newsbud.com, I believe it is. And then James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com, are three of my favorites.
Some of my favorite websites that I check in with frequently are, one is called geoengineeringwatch.org. That's geoengineeringwatch.org. And that is a site dedicated to exposing the truth about geoengineering and weather modification that's happening.
And weaponized weather.
And weaponized
yeah.
weather.
Yeah.
And people know nothing at all about this. I know when I've gone on the air, one of the nice things about bringing up chemtrails is that people can, on most days, go outside and see them above their heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's an abstract conspiracy theory. They can look up, and there they are, crisscrossing the skies. So that's a really cool website. I know there's a couple of great 9/11 Truth websites. The one that I've written several articles for is 911tap.org, which stands for the Truth Action Project. I have some of my musical endeavors are up on that website, a review of the book Truthers that we mentioned before, and a few other items. So there are plenty of great websites out there to check out.
Yeah, and the other one I wanted to mention that you about 9/11 was Architects and Engineers for 9/11truth.org, where there's close to 3,000 architects and engineers who have examined the collapse of the towers and say it was definitely controlled demolition. They have found samples of nanothermite in the dust and all that, which you're never going to hear in the corporate media. So please check those out if you want to know what's really going on, because you're not getting that from the corporate mainstream media.
All excellent suggestions, Cheryl.
And I do want to say, read books. I have to say, I know maybe people don't do that anymore, but if you read this book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. by Dr. William Pepper,
your outlook on life will be changed forever. It's just it's such a sobering eye-opener.
And half of the book is documents. He's copied every document he had and the transcripts from interviews with people. So you don't have to just take his word for it. No. It's right there. It's all there. This book is a treasure of truth and honesty at how our system really works.
Exactly.
Yeah. Carl, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. Is there any thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Just keep on speaking truth to power, Cheryl. You're a real beacon of light for us, and we really appreciate all the work that you do here on WWH-FM.
Well, thank you very much, Carl, and likewise to you. I appreciate all the work that you do.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for being on today.
Thank you.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
You're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
On May 14th, the Israeli military slaughtered 62 Palestinians as they massed at Gaza's border with Israel, demanding their right to return to their homeland. But this is not the first time Israel has murdered unarmed Gazan civilians. Independent journalists Mac Blumenthal and Dan Cohen documented Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza during the war and chronicled its horrific aftermath. As they waded through the rubble of Gaza's destroyed border regions, they turned a camera onto the survivors of the slaughter and let them speak for themselves. While giving voice to the pain of a people under siege, Cohen and Blumenthal also highlighted Gazans' inspiring act of creative resistance, from painting to breakdancing to literature that allowed them to maintain their humanity in the face of deprivation and war. Killing Gaza is much more than a documentary about Palestinian resistance and suffering. It is a chilling visual document of war crimes committed by the Israeli military, featuring direct testimony and evidence from the survivors, delivered to them often just days after escaping indiscriminate shelling, bombings, and summary execution. And now we welcome Max Blumenthal, director and writer of Killing Gaza. He is a senior editor of the Greystone Project at Alternet, and the award-winning author of Goliath, Republican Gomorrah, and the 51-Day War. And Dan Cohen, cinematographer and editor of Killing Gaza. He's a journalist and filmmaker.
I really want to understand the background and the politics that prompted both of you to use cinematography as a way of telling the story of this strip that is 6 miles wide and 27 miles long, has 2 million people enclosed in what is oftentimes described as the largest open-air prison in the world.
Dan Cohen and I would both define ourselves as anti-Zionist Jews. We both grew up in very Zionist communities. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My family I would describe as non-Zionist, and they've always encouraged me to question everything, so they didn't really have a problem to my emerging politics, and I think I was going where more progressive-minded American Jews was going, and Dan as well, and it led me as a journalist to start deciding to use my privilege as a Jew to gain access to the land of Israel-Palestine and present the real Israel that Americans didn't know and help start this process of education so we could have a debate in the U.S. And that's why I produced the book Goliath. It was 5 years in the making. And, you know, I thought that I had kind of succeeded enough with that book that I could maybe move on to other topics. And then the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip took place. I managed to get into Gaza along with Dan. Dan had been living and being in the Idaq refugee camp or near it in the West Bank, and we connected and went in there not knowing totally what to expect. And we wound up a few hours after getting credentialed in the rubble, the destroyed eastern border area of Shujaya, which had been blanketed by Israeli artillery, talking to the stunned survivors of this attack and the ruins of their homes. Dan just had a small camera and one mic, And we decided to just keep going. And as we kept going, a documentary took form. And I would kind of let Dan explain, I mean, not only his background, but how he kept the filming going over the course of another year.
You know, I didn't really grow up in any kind of politicized community. Much of my identity as a secular Jewish American from the suburbs of Phoenix was, you know, to be supportive of Israel, as if to be a good Jew is to support Israel. I had my bar mitzvah in Israel, Jerusalem, and it wasn't until my early 20s when I was in college and I took a history class that I started to get a grasp of what had actually happened in that country, and I became uncomfortable with that and started consuming a lot of media, reading a lot of books. Eventually, I found myself reading Max's book, Goliath. That was one of the major inspirations for me, pushed me over the edge to say, like, I'm going to dive into journalism head first and go to Palestine and just take my camera and see what happens. And that's what I did, and right after I arrived, I moved into the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, and I just saw this daily violence. Aida camp is used more tear gas than anywhere in the world. I would see Israeli soldiers shoot children on a daily basis, and just really the horrors of everyday occupation in the West Bank. A few months later, Max and I met, and we got credentialed, went into the Gaza Strip. You know, my background at that point was in photography. I didn't really know anything about video, but I just felt like it was such a powerful form. I started taking footage just of our interviews that we were getting in the rubble so we could transcribe the content for written articles. But it became very clear to us that the content we were getting, the testimonies of survival and death, were so compelling, so powerful, that they should form the basis for a documentary. The content was so strong. We stayed until the end of the assault, and I decided to make it my kind of personal mission to continue to go back and document life after the ceasefire, which was really a one-way ceasefire. You know, you'd still have periodic bombings, Israeli soldiers shooting into the border areas all the time, and all of these Palestinians who'd had their homes destroyed. There were more than 100,000 homes destroyed in Gaza. They were largely not allowed to rebuild their homes. So there was nothing normal about life in Gaza, and I wanted to document that and show the everyday crises that Palestinians were surviving under. Through the winter, in the freezing rains, babies are actually freezing to death, and we show that. We have the mother talking about that in the documentary. The Mediterranean summer, you know, right off the beach, where people whose homes were destroyed are living in shipping containers where it's just absolute misery, elderly people, children, suffering that really we in the U.S. and Israelis, you know, just a half a mile away in the border communities outside of Gaza, really cannot grasp. And so, you know, it was through film that we thought it was just the most powerful way to show this, especially in the age of social media and YouTube and Vimeo. And we're going to be pushed out. We're not going to be allowed into the mainstream. It's not going to be shown in AMC theaters. You know, we're not going to get interviews on CNN or MSNBC, but we're going to do it in the grassroots way. And really, people, I think, are hungry for it. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, that's where we are today.
Well, you certainly succeeded. This is something that really makes the violence real and the murder real, the murder of civilians by the Israeli forces. Was it worse than you thought it would be?
One of the things that I've noticed, even for people who are sympathetic to Palestine, is just in how you experience the violence. And it's very difficult, obviously, to get into the Gaza Strip. It's one of the most off-limits places in the world. And so you experience the violence through a kind of simulacra, whether it's on your smartphone or a flat screen or your laptop, and you're seeing it kind of in bites and montages. I mean, it's hard to really get full context, but more importantly, you can't experience intimacy with the victims of Israeli violence if you can't go to the Gaza Right. Strip and really spend time there. And that's really what I wasn't expecting was the encounter with people who had withstood something that was completely unimaginable to me and, you know, even to them to some extent, and to witness how they coped with it. That was really the focus of our film, was, and the goal of our film was to establish the atmosphere of siege and being on the receiving end of asymmetrical warfare, to follow these characters and show their psychological progression, their stoicism, the culture of resistance that they've formed to psychologically survive. From a cinematic point of view, what we aimed to do aesthetically was to get as close to their faces as possible, to bring you into their world, into their homes, which in many cases were not really homes, they were rubble, to bring you as close as possible to sitting around a fire in the cold Gaza winter while it's raining outside, and to feel what it's like, because most people watching this film won't be able to be there. What they'll come away with is not only a kind of empathy, but also admiration for these people and what they're able to do under these circumstances. There's a lot of courage in Gaza that we don't understand unless, you know, you can either be there or you can have a kind of cinematic experience, like the kind that I'm confident we produced with Killing Gaza. You can watch it at killinggaza.com. Costs you probably less than a coffee to rent or buy the film.
The perpetual nature of the assault on each individual is so stark, is startling. You certainly get a sense of the disproportionate use of force, since we're always fed the mythology that Israel is acting not as the purveyor of violence, but it is indeed the David to the Goliath of the great Arab world that seeks to destroy it. And you've really broken through that. It serves to me as a basis for a project that looked to the indictment, if nothing else, before a people's tribunal of war crimes. I wonder if you've thought of the film as serving as a mobilizing tool and indeed possibly an international war crime to finally tell it like it is on behalf of the freedom fighters of Gaza.
This is not just a documentary. It is a document that should be entered into evidence if there was an international criminal court. But if there's a people's tribunal, great. This film should be entered into evidence. We provided in this the first opening section of this film, but throughout the film, clear evidence of crimes against humanity committed by the State of Israel and done so deliberately against the civilian population.
The scope of the film, the idea of the film, and what's missing really in Western mainstream media is just to show Palestinians as human beings and, you know, have like an intimate portrait of them, that the most important thing is to understand that all of the suffering in Gaza is rubber stamped and paid for with American tax dollars, and we have to understand our own complicity in it. And, you know, if we really rallied in Washington, D.C., in New York, if there was, you know, enough people really getting out there, then I think the bipartisan consensus in U.S. politics of support for Israel, unbridled impunity, would really be challenged, and we'd see, especially in the Democratic Party, we would see the shift really taking place. And I think we do see it in terms of Democratic leaders, or, you know, who have previously been vocally supportive of Israel, even during these massacres. In this most recent massacre, where 60 people were gunned down simply for approaching the fence, they were gunned down by Israeli snipers who were totally untouchable. Democratic leaders have been silent. And so that indicates a real shift to me. And that is what we want to continue to hit on, to continue to press on. And that's, you know, the goal of the film.
Dan was able to get into a training camp of the Nasser al-Saladin Brigade, which is a popular resistance brigade. They're kind of the weekend warriors of Gaza. And he spoke to some of the young fighters on camera about why they fight. And it's something that people in the West will never hear. Why do they fight? They fight because their relatives, their parents, their friends, they've watched them be torn to shreds by Israeli missiles supplied by the United States, and that's what they say on camera. They don't give religious justifications. Dan asked them. Another thing Dan did was profile the younger brother of Salem Shamali, who is one of the most widely known deaths in the war. He was a 23-year-old street vendor who was looking for his cousin in the rubble, was killed execution style by an Israeli sniper on camera. It was broadcast on international networks. And Dan followed Wasim and showed his development. Dan can talk about that, but you see Wasim turn from a regular kid into someone who wants to be a resistance fighter. And I think this also helps us to understand why those young men rushed into the teeth of Israeli snipers and a hail of bullets pursuing freedom and ventilating their frustration with siege. We need to understand their lived experiences.
I do want you to talk more about the young brother of this man who we see being gratuitously and viciously executed by, whether it's a sniper or a group of snipers. It is one of the more gut-wrenching, painful films. Also, another element of the film, which is life, the resilience, and indeed the optimism and creativity that is physically expressed amidst all of this perpetual assault on the human spirit and the human body.
Salem Shamali was searching in the rubble of Shujaiya, which had been largely destroyed by Israeli artillery and tank shells, a whole neighborhood obliterated. So this young man went back to look for his cousin, search out family members who might have survived during the ceasefire, and he was accompanied by volunteers from the International Solidarity Movement. As they were walking through the rubble, through these streets, an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Salem Shamali, and he fell to the ground, and the rescuers couldn't reach him because they would be shot too. And then the Israeli sniper proceeded to finish him off with two more shots. This was captured on cell phone camera by a volunteer, Mohammed Abdullah, who's from Gaza. It was uploaded and went viral. So a couple days later, Salem Shamali was simply, he was unknown. No one knew who he was. He was just known as the man in the green shirt. So a few days later, an NBC report was sent to Salem Shamali's family, and that's how they learned of his death, just from a news report. And they heard his voice and instantly knew it was him, as he was, you know, crying out as he's dying. About 2 weeks later, Max and I went to visit the Shamali family in a home where they were staying in a relatively safer area in the center of Gaza City. The family was just completely devastated. It was just the most fresh wound for them, and everyone was deeply traumatized. And the youngest brother, Wasim, who I believe was 14 at that time, was a very mild-mannered, nice boy. He just told us how he missed his brother. He would take him out, buy him a candy, and take care of him and just hang out with him. And now there was no one there to do that. And so his voice was quivering, and he was crying, but he was so brave that he spoke to us on camera. About a year later, I went to the Shamali household again and caught up with them. And Wasim the trauma had basically scarred him so bad that he couldn't hear properly, couldn't really concentrate for long periods of time. He took me to the graveyard where Salem was buried, which was just a makeshift graveyard because the actual graveyard of Shujaiya was completely filled and was overflowing with bodies. And so basically empty lots of land were turned into makeshift graveyards. And so we went there, and he sat at his brother's grave and told me he goes there every Friday, doesn't really do much else. And all he thinks about now is joining the Al-Qassam Brigades, the main armed resistance group. It's Hamas's armed wing. And not because he's some religious fanatic, but simply because he wants vengeance for his brother. Anybody can relate to that. And that's a pattern that I saw talking to so many young boys, especially, who had been either maimed themselves and had severe injuries, or their brothers or cousins or parents had been killed. There's a video I did for The Nation. It's called The Children Who Live Under Israel's Missiles, about the Bakr boys who were hit by Israeli missiles. They were targeted as they were playing on the beach. There were 8 of them. 4 died, 4 survived. The 4 survivors, they all told me they want to be fighters. And every one of them are, you know, they're on that path. When those kids, in a few years, if they pop out of a tunnel and opened fire on some Israeli pillbox military installation of some like 19-year-old soldiers sitting around eating bomba, then it'll be very clear why it happened. And all the faux outrage that we'll see in Western media about terror attack and Netanyahu going on CBS and saying, oh, these bloodthirsty terrorists, well, it's all a lie because we know exactly why they did it. They told us they were going to. Anyone in that situation would do that. But at the same time, there are people who take up arms and join resistance groups, but there is also a very bright culture of unarmed resistance. We filmed with Gaza's first b-boy breakdancing crew, and they basically told us the only way for them to maintain their sanity in such conditions, unable to travel, to interact with other dancers, to improve their craft, to just get a taste of the world, was to dance. The way they could keep from losing their minds. You see them in the film. This young painter, Alek Matar, who was a 15-year-old girl and was depressed in her room while these bombs dropped, took up painting by kind of accident, and she blossomed into this incredible artist in a very short time. And now her work is on display around the world, and she's just one of Gaza's brightest stars. And so we try to show that it's not just about armed resistance, and it's not just about suffering. It's not only Palestinians are victims, but they don't take on this victimhood complex and wallow in their suffering. They find different ways to resist and assert their humanity in the face of unimaginable violence and oppression.
There were so many instances of the slaughter of civilian population, of unarmed civilians, by the Israeli forces. I wonder if you can give us another one or two examples of it, even though there are so many in the film.
In addition to listening to us talk about the film, you can rent it or watch it at killinggaza.com. And in killinggaza.com, you will meet Mahmoud Abu Said. He was a 19-year-old who we met outside of the southern city of Rafah. Israeli soldiers came into his area, pulled him out of his house during Ramadan, shot his father, and sent the family marching away, and took him as a human shield back into the house, stood him in front of windows. And the kid was completely traumatized when we met him. And they shot over his shoulders and began sniping his neighbors to death. Then they took him to a prison inside Israel for 2 weeks, and he had just gotten out of prison when we met him. He was just kind of like, he had this look in his eyes of just, his eyes were bloodshot. You could tell he just hadn't been sleeping, and he reenacted the experience for us in a really chilling way on camera. You could see the sniper hole that the Israelis had punched in the walls of his house, and then we walked across the street. It was a surreal experience walking across the street. We felt the crunch of MK-82 500-pound bombs made by General Dynamics in the U.S. under our feet, the shrapnel. We walked over the shrapnel. There were mortars in the street. Houses were just destroyed by bulldozers and bombs. And we met an older man, Suleiman Srebi, who showed us his son's taxi cab, which had been bombed by a drone. He was standing by his house, which had been destroyed by an Israeli missile, and his son had been shot in the head by an Israeli sniper who was using the neighbor, Mahmoud Abu Said, as a human shield. I mean, the amount of violence that was withstood there, the sadistic, unbelievable violence was just mind-boggling. And he said, you know, what can I do? We've been living this violence our whole lives. You build a house, they bomb the house. You till a field, they burn the field. You raise a son, they kill the son. And all we want to do now is resist and resist and resist. We have nothing else to do. And that's the story of Gaza. That's the story of the protests. That's the story of the 58 young people who were cut down by Israeli snipers with laser range finders. And that's what we show in Killing Gaza, along with inspiring stories of resistance.
For every indignity, for every injustice, and there's a myriad way that you show that it happens, there are the smaller and constant indignities and pressures, and yet there are these glorious moments that are there of resistance and individual expression of life. It was the breakdancing, it was the young boy singing amidst the rubble of a mosque. I want to talk about what that did for your spirit and your energy and should do for us to support the people of Gaza, the people who are in all of the occupied territories by an increasingly vicious, monstrous state of Israel. Take us to that note, because there was that richness of the human endeavor and the reality of being a freedom fighter.
Everybody is living under immense psychological pressure, you know, where there's a suicide epidemic that gets very little coverage in Gaza. You know, this is just purely a result of deprivation that 2 million people are surviving under. But at the same time, there is, you know, the Arabic word is sumud. The best translation in English is steadfastness. And so that's something that anyone who goes to Palestine with an open mind and an open heart really gets a sense of, and nowhere more than Gaza, where you meet so many people who have been through so much suffering, so much devastation for generations now, but there's this national identity and just something deeper that they really hold on to and maintain in the face of really unimaginable oppression.
Many of the people we know who are our age or younger, they're the English speakers, the educated people, they have been forced to leave and find a life outside of Gaza. In many ways, it's like another Nakba, where they have to leave their families and friends behind. They hope that one day they can come back to Gaza, but meanwhile, Palestinians are hoping they can one day come back to their land and homes in what is now Israel. You just see this gradual process of a society being systematically destroyed, but at the same time, the Palestinian diaspora is filled with all of this talent that's leaving Gaza, and there's a brain drain going on. But there's a lot you can do in your own community, and you know, you can connect with people from Palestine in your community, you can connect with organizations, but it's just really important to mobilize, especially at this time. I really feel like one of the most inspiring things is the way that the debate has been shifted by people who've been fighting pro-Israel lobby and the pro-Israel consensus in the West. And that campaign was really started by Palestinians in the diaspora. The debate is totally shifting in the United States, and Israel knows it. Progressive-minded people generally don't support Netanyahu's Israel, and that support is never coming back. We hope that this film can be a vehicle for helping people understand Gaza and what's been done in their name with their tax dollars. It should also encourage them to get active within their communities, especially after the massacre we saw and the sort of passive response of U.S. media.
How can people support this film and make sure that it is disseminated? It is one of the most powerful stories of the triumph, really, of the will, of resistance, of freedom, resilience, and creativity of a people who for 70 years plus have been fighting for their land, for their identity, and against one of the most virulent war machines in the world, aided and abetted, financed, and supported by the U.S. governments.
Rent the film at killinggaza.com for $3 and show it to friends at home if you've been arguing with about Israel-Palestine or who seems to be on the fence. Show it to them. Buy the film for $5 and do a screening in your community. And if Dan or I can get there, we'd be happy to participate. KillingGaza.com.
I have nothing but admiration for the work on one of the most important struggles in the world, the issue of Palestine as the question for the instability in the Middle East, for the efforts to work to support a free Palestine. You have given us an enormously important tool to learn from to build support.
This This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
What does the Quran say about homosexuality in the original translation?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. The term is non-existent.
How can Islam and homosexuality be compatible?
I am Muslim. I am a gay man. You know, I'm a father. I'm a lover. I'm a person of color. You know, we cannot put this human identity in a binary code.
Smile.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Northern Ireland's marriage impasse withstands common sense, Pakistan's sweeping trans rights bill awaits presidential assent, and a gay Muslim cleric reads the Quran with a queer consciousness. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 12, 2018. A bill in Britain's House of Commons to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in Northern Ireland was blocked from coming to the floor on May 11th by a backbench Conservative Party MP. The move prevented the scheduled second reading of the bill, which generally has cross-party support, and would have provided the first chance for MPs to debate it. Northern Ireland-born Labour Party MP Conor McGinn's private member's bill sought to bypass the essentially non-functioning Northern Ireland government. Its two major parties have been unable to reach a power-sharing agreement for more than 17 months. Marriage equality is one of the major stumbling blocks. The ruling Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, staunchly opposes equality, while the Sinn Féin Party strongly supports it. The most recent public opinion polls in Northern Ireland show that close to 3 in 4 respondents in the last major part of the UK without it strongly favor marriage equality. Because private members' bills don't often become law in the UK, queer activists have been calling on the government of Prime Minister Theresa May to resolve the impasse by offering its own Northern Ireland marriage equality bill. But May has insisted that the issue needs to be addressed by the Northern Ireland Assembly, if and whenever the government there begins to function again. According to McGinn, the next chance for lawmakers in the House of Commons to debate his bill won't come until October 26th. "We are not going away," he said, "and we are not giving up." A companion private member's bill is currently under consideration in the House of Lords. But John O'Doherty of the Love Equality Campaign said that responsibility for legislation now sits primarily with Theresa May, Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley, and the new Equalities Minister, Penny Mordaunt, and we will seek urgent meetings with them to discuss the next steps.
Pakistan's National Assembly approved the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Bill 2018 on May 9th. Queer activists are celebrating what are seen as sweeping upgrades to the rights and protections of trans people as the bill calls for their protection, relief, and rehabilitation of rights. Among its specific provisions, the measure punishes anyone who kidnaps or forces a trans person to engage in non-consensual sex with up to life in prison or even execution. It also allows trans people to legally change the gender designation on their government documents without a medical board's approval, and specifically outlaws discrimination against trans people in employment, education, medical services, public transportation, inheritance, housing, voting, and holding public office. Even transgender prisoners are to be kept in separate facilities away from the general population to protect them from being assaulted. As if to demonstrate the urgent need for this legislation, the 57th Pakistani transgender woman since 2015 and the fourth this year was brutally murdered this week, in this case simply for being unable to break a 1,000 rupee bill into smaller currency. The Senate has already passed the Protection of Rights Bill. It now needs the signature of President Mamnoon Hussein to become law.
But Portugal's president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, vetoed a bill this week that would have made it easier for trans teenagers to change their gender on government documents. Portuguese lawmakers passed the bill almost a month ago. It would allow citizens as young as 16 to legally change gender as long as they have the consent of their parents or legal representatives. But de Sousa demanded that the additional approval of a medical board be mandatory for minors. The bill would also ban unnecessary surgery on intersex children, which activists say can cause lifelong problems. Portuguese equality supporters remain hopeful about eventual passage of the bill. The country's constitution allows lawmakers to either pass a revised bill that incorporates the president's demands or overturn his veto of the original bill by a simple majority vote. Its enactment would make Portugal the sixth European country to adopt a self-identification gender recognition law, joining Malta, Norway, Denmark, Ireland, and Belgium.
The Greek legislature has taken another baby step in the advance of LGBTQ rights by voting to allow same-gender couples in civil partnerships to be foster parents. However, they're still not allowed to adopt, so the familial relationship would be only temporary. The bill was approved by a vote of 161-103 in the 300-seat parliament on May 9th. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said that fostering provides for the return of the child to its natural parents, who must retain contact with the child during its fostering time. He added, however, that it would not be an exaggeration to say that fostering is an act of altruism, solidarity, and service of those who choose it. Greek lawmakers allowed gay and lesbian couples to enter into less-than-marriage civil partnerships in 2015 and passed a bill to protect LGBT people from workplace discrimination a year later. And in 2017, they removed the requirement that trans people be sterilized before being allowed to legally change their gender.
In other news, the Council of Bishops of the U.S.-based United Methodist Church endorsed a proposal this week to essentially pass the buck on resolving sharp differences about the role of LGBT people in the church and let local congregations decide what suits them best. The proposal calls for the removal of language in the church's Book of Discipline that labels homosexuality incompatible with Christian teaching and says that self-avowed practicing homosexuals cannot be ordained as ministers appointed to serve or married in the church. The elimination of that language allows local pastors and congregations to ordain out clergy and or welcome church weddings of same-gender couples if they so choose. The bishop's endorsement is seen as an effort to forestall a threatened schism in America's second-largest Protestant denomination over the role of LGBTQ parishioners in the church. It comes ahead of a special session of the General Conference in February 2019 to address the queer-related issues that have roiled the denomination for more than 20 years. The bishops say that the so-called One Church proposal would allow United Methodist congregations, particularly in more traditionalist African nations, to maintain their opposition to LGBT inclusion. However, critics note that a similar proposal failed in committee at the General Conference in 2016. There are two other proposals that are expected to be advanced at the General Conference special session. One keeps the existing language condemning homosexuality in the Book of Discipline, while the other allows regional conferences to determine which stance their congregations will take. But Jan Lawrence of the Church's Queer Inclusive Reconciling Ministries Network told the Christian Post that none of the options provide equity and justice to the LGBTQ community or welcomes and celebrates the lives of LGBTQ people.
And finally,
that's why it's called the trap, that's why it's called the project, because it's exactly that. All these people is going to kill me. Because the more I reveal me, the more they're afraid of the real me. Welcome back, Carter. Smile.
Jay-Z, real name Sean Carter, dedicated Smile, one of the tracks on his latest album, 444, to his mother Gloria Carter, who also appears on the track reading her coming out poem. The now-out lesbian mom of the hip-hop mogul emotionally accepted a special recognition award from queer media watchdog GLAAD in a ceremony in New York City on May 5th. As is often the case in close-knit families, Gloria Carter's sexual orientation was apparently known to most of her children and relatives, but just not discussed. In her acceptance speech, she revealed that Jay-Z cried when she finally came out to him. "It must have been horrible to live that way for so long," she quotes him as saying. In an earlier interview, she said that, "The song came about because I was sitting there one day, and I just finally started telling my son who I was. That made him want to do a song about it." She said she was initially reluctant to participate on the album. "I wrote my verse on the plane going out to LA," she said. "I gave it to him, and he said, 'Start reading this.' And he was taping me." Here's how Gloria Carter concluded her GLAAD acceptance speech and a taste of her part on the award-winning track.
"Here I am. I'm loving. I'm respectful. I'm productive. And I'm a human being who has a right to love who I love. Thank you and God bless." "Living in this chattel feels like the safe place to be. No harm for them, no harm for me. But life is short. And it's time to be free. Love who you love because life isn't guaranteed. Smile."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending May 12, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap for This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the newly renovated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Just as it is with Judaism and Christianity, the popular assumption is that Islam and the other Abrahamic religions uniformly condemn homosexuality and gender variance. LGBTQ Christians and Jews have made great strides in proving that that assumption is false, and groups within Islam are beginning to turn the tide in their faith too. Melbourne, Australia-based Imam Nur Wasami is the founder of the queer Muslim support group Marhaba Inc., as well as a welcoming mosque. While in Sydney for Mardi Gras, he chatted with This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay at a nearby park about the changes and the resistance to change in the Muslim community.
Firstly, Imam Nuth, why did you decide to set up an LGBTIQ-friendly mosque in Melbourne, and how successful has it been?
I think primarily what I was looking for before the mosque 4 years ago, in fact it will be 5 years this November, was two things. One was a safe house for young people that were stuck in environments that were causing them family traumas. Because for a young person to transition safely, they can't be stuck in that environment. So a safe house so that they could keep the contact with the family, but at the same time find their independence. And secondly was a drop-in center where we could have a facility to educate parents in how to reinterpret scriptures that are outdated in a more contemporary fashion. The idea of the mosque came later on because as the numbers started increasing, people were asking questions, we would like to go to a mosque. I mean, we had a member, a lesbian girl who is Muslim and her religion is spirituality is important to her, but she went to a particular mosque and at the women's section, even though she was wearing the scarf as part of the tradition, another female in the congregation said, "Dress properly, otherwise leave."
So people that were rejected from this type of institutions, I thought, okay, how can we have this type of facility? And, you know, I'm a bit cautious of calling it a mosque. It was a spiritual healing center.
What does the Quran say about homosexuality in the original translation?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. The term is non-existent.
Okay, so there's nothing like in the Old Testament they talk about man lying with man.
It's not as specific as in the Bible. I mean, there is one verse in the Quran that talks, it's the same. The commonalities are quite extraordinary when it comes to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. But the term homosexuality, the term is non-existent. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah, a lot has been used over the years in this mainly three Abrahamic religions to condemn LGBTIQ, queer people of different backgrounds. And I studied commentary of the Quran, and in the Muslim scriptures, what they sin, these two particular villages that were by the Dead Sea in Jordan, in that area, where they used to wage wars on each other, tribal wars. And it was a strategy of war that they used to use, which was to rape men, women, children, which is even till today is used in my country of origin, Somalia. When a tribe would come wage war on another tribe, and Somalia is the only country in the whole of Africa that speaks one language, has one religion, one sect, there's not even Sunni Shia.
So you're really saying that the anti-LGBTIQ push in the Muslim world is solely based on the story of Sodom and Gomorrah?
Correct. And there are clear scriptures that talk about, for example, verses that talk about interest being proscribed, not allowed, by a house on interest. Very clear verses. There are scriptures that talk about alcohol. There are scriptures that talk about gambling. Yet we Muslims always find a way to justify it. So the first family home is justified. You can buy it since it's because you're looking after the family. Or if a person is into gambling or alcohol, they say, oh, the boy or the girl is going through a phase and they will be fine. However, the violent reaction when it comes to LGBTIQ, queer individuals in the Muslim tradition, I think because homosexuality challenges the notion of this masculinity, this gender roles. And that's why any threat to that masculinity is looked at and responded to in a very violent way, even though there are no scriptures. Muhammad, and one of the questions you'll ask is, did Muhammad say anything about LGBT? He never said throw gay people. In fact, he ordered for people to look after the transgender community in his lifetime. But those texts have somehow been kept away, and there's been this one particular ideology in the Muslim world predominantly that has been, you know, flooding even intellectual minds when it comes to Islamic institutions and universities.
Wahhabism, correct. Yeah, the Wahhabist tradition. Yeah.
With the help of the oil money.
From Saudi Arabia. Yeah. So how can Islam and homosexuality, or being a person of an LGBTIQ background, be compatible?
I am here. You're interviewing me. You know, I am Muslim. I am a gay man. You know, I'm a father. I'm a lover. I'm a person of color. You know, we cannot put this human identity in a binary code. And spirituality and sexuality are but two qualities that make a person who have several qualities. They're just two qualities of a person. In the Muslim tradition, like in any patriarchal societies, even in the Christian world, it was like that, in the Jewish world, there is this binary, you know, a man's role is this and a woman's role is this. You can't. It's a very simplistic way of putting something that is not to be confined in a small space, which is the human identity, the human spirit. What is condemned in Islam is this notion of if you have a partner, for example, and interestingly, there are verses that talk about same-sex couples in the Quran. Same-sex couples,
really?
That would go cheat on a partner. So what is condemned is that lack of loyalty when it comes to relationships. Yes, there are verses that talk about ladani and latani, the two men that will go and deceive. One of them is in a relationship, similar to adultery in the heterosexual world. And it's condemned in the Quran. Yet that commentary is somehow say, oh, no, no, it means, you know, two heterosexual men that do that. But it is not true. It is not true.
So really, there are scriptures in the Quran which do acknowledge same-sex attraction and men and women who are attracted to each other.
Correct.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. Support your local public radio station. You ain't going to get this nowhere else.
What is the predominant school of thought when it comes to homosexuality in the Islamic world? You mentioned Wahhabism. That's one of the widest, I guess, conservative strands of Islamic thought in the world today.
So that has been a big problem for me. I mean, I went to some very, very rural villages in some of the Pacific Islands, and these are villages you can't reach by... There's no roads, you have to climb a mountain, canoe, and their books are there. And an ideology that's being funded. And you know, the West are also culprits in this. Saudi Arabia wouldn't have existed if it wasn't by the West's support in that region and the oil. And they have used the oil money to flood one particular ideology, which is very extreme, violent, patriarchal, tribal, and maniacal way of interpreting Islam. And hence, when you see ISIS and things like that, it is the same mentality, which is not Islam, which is not what the original Islam of Muhammad was.
Groups such as the Islamic State and the regime in Iran and Chechnya persecute and execute people for being gay. Is this justified in Islamic law?
It is not justified at all. In fact, you know, there's a saying ascribed to Muhammad that says this Adami, Al-Adamiyu Bunyanur Rabb, this human being is a structure that God created. And then he says Rabbi Mal'unun Man Hadama, by God cursed is the person who demolishes this structure. And I come back to when Iran, I mean Iran, you're talking about a very conservative Ayatollah led country. Saudi Arabia, the same. Chechnya, interestingly, they have a lot of support from the Saudi regime. These people are people who are still perpetuating this school of thought, and it's not something that is allowed in Islam at all.
Why is there such a hatred and persecution of LGBTIQ people in these conservative Islamic regimes?
I think the Christian world has gone through this wars of inquisition when the church and the state were separating. I think now what is happening in that region is you see, I think what we're going through is a bit similar to those wars, because the grip of religion in every aspect of one's life is very tight. Unfortunately, the media doesn't mention this, but there are positive signs. There are spaces being carved out in the world. Groups are reaching out from places I never thought. When I started the group, I remember in November 2013, 1 year later, I got contacted by a person in Jeddah, in Saudi Arabia, saying we have started this LGBT underground group. I got contacted by a group in Tehran, in Iran, transgender support group. So young people are very innovative and they're finding ways, and the online platform has been fascinating.
And you've been helping with the Rainbow Railroad organization.
Yes, we have heard about the Chechen LGBT. Interestingly, you hear about gay and bisexual men, but there is no mention of the lesbian women, and they exist there. And it's a way of safety. They would get married, you know, but still gagged. So thankfully, you know, we have our group. We haven't had much support when it comes to funding-wise. But last Ramadan, the last fasting month, I remember people were saying, why don't you organize a fasting iftar, get together? So we did that, and it was in collaboration with a group called Minus 18 in Melbourne, and they hosted us in their place. So I said, instead of just coming and eating and everyone going home, think of your brothers and sisters in Chechnya, and let's put money together. And it was the first fundraising event that we have done, and we were involved in helping a lot of this gay men move from Moscow. And I know some of the people that run the safe houses in Moscow. But the Russian government is still quite homophobic. So they allowed those centers, and these centers are by people who are, you know, some of them academics, some of them workers, but out of their goodness, they decided to facilitate this platform. But they lack even basic means, you know, old mattresses and things like that. So we said, how can we celebrate the month of Ramadan, the fasting month, but also give back to these people? So we were one of the groups that helped these young people move from Moscow to Toronto.
Why are we seeing a backlash in some places in the Islamic world, like Indonesia at the moment, where they're calling for the death penalty in Aceh, for example, for people who are gay?
Well, you know, when one feels threatened, they will hold on to anything. And I think particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia, and they were on my gaze since I started the group in November 2013. There is a large number of LGBT young people that are crying out. I mean, there is the transgender run mosque, and say it's like a refuge for transgender Indonesians. And I know the BB that runs that place. Initially, the media said that it was closed down, but it wasn't closed down. They said, you know, we will shut you down. The government threatened them. But they couldn't provide an alternative for these people that were sheltered in that venue. I think the backlash is they're trying to, say, scare people into going back underground, because there are a lot of voices that are speaking out. And you know now, this year, you will have the first Indonesian float that will be marching as part of the Mardi Gras. So there are young people. And just before I came from Melbourne, I was visited by a scholar from the Islamic University in Kuala Lumpur who's doing LGBT advocacy in both Indonesia and Malaysia. And he said even within Majlis al-Ulama, the Council of Scholars, there are imams who are saying, okay, we really have to do something about this, and we want to support the LGBT youth particularly. So there is a shift even in ways of thinking, which is promising.
Australian gay imam Nur Wasami and his compatriots in Indonesia and Malaysia still have a difficult battle ahead. Just this week, Indonesia's top Muslim clerical body issued a fatwa against all LGBTI behaviors. And in Malaysia, the government began blocking online information about HIV/AIDS and LGBT travel. However, Wasami remains undaunted, especially when it comes to young people.
For those LGBT people who have grown up in the Islamic tradition, what psychological effect does it have on their well-being?
As a friend of mine who's an academic said, it's similar to being involved in a severe car accident where you have to go into rehabilitation to recover. So I thought, okay, how can I facilitate a platform where we can provide healing?
Sydney correspondent Barry McKay's conversation with Imam Nur Wasami concludes next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney, with thanks to Brian DeShazer and from Barry McKay. Brian Eno and David Byrne performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2UUU Nauru, New South Wales, WZKW Kingsville, Ohio, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. I'm C.S. Song. Karl Marx's ideas continue to resonate today, which, when you think about it, is kind of amazing. Marx died in 1883, and in the intervening 135 years, a lot has changed in how capitalism operates and in how people work. Which brings up an important question, one taken up by a documentary film called Marx Reloaded. The question being, what is the contemporary relevance of Karl Marx's insights? Marx Reloaded, written and directed by Jason Barker, features a number of prominent and influential radical thinkers, including Michael Hart, Slavoj Žižek, Antonio Negri, and Jacques Rancière. It also features a number of animated sequences. Today, we'll present audio excerpts of the film, as well as portions of an interview I conducted with the filmmaker, Jason Barker. The film, Marx Reloaded, is, by the way, our thank you gift to you for a pledge of $120 or more to listener-supported KPFA. You can make that pledge anytime this hour by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. Easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Now, Jason Barker is a deep thinker in his own right. A professor at the European Graduate School, Jason has taught widely on film, media theory, and philosophy. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Cardiff University. When Jason Barker joined me by phone, I asked him how in vogue Karl Marx's work is today.
There's not just one Marx, and there's not just one Marxism. And so what you've got today, I guess, is not just one revival, but a whole kind of bunch of them, different people, even people from kind of who you'd describe as liberal economists like Thomas Piketty. I mean, he's not really engaging with Marx, but he's engaging, or he's trying to come up with a concept of capital and capitalism, which is more or less within the sort of Marxian tradition. So I kind of, you know, to answer the question, there are always Marxist revivals. They kind of come in waves. But I guess today, yeah, probably today's is slightly different in the sense that there are just so many different interpretations of Marx.
And I wonder about, because there seems to be a tension in perhaps the way you made the film. You have a limited amount of time. On the one hand, you want people to talk about Marx's ideas, what they actually were back then. On the other hand, you want to examine whether Marx's ideas apply to capitalism as it operates today. So how did you deal with that tension, that kind of dual mission?
I mean, this is the whole challenge, I suppose, of doing a film about Marx. I mean, how much do you kind of concentrate on, you know, who he was? Because obviously so much of his theory, so much of his ideas are really grounded in his own time. And so, of course, you've got this challenge, as I say, between balancing out that very kind of specific historical context that Marx was dealing with and then kind of bringing it forward into the present. I mean, this is always a challenge. It's a challenge for anyone who does this kind of film based on a historical figure, right? I mean, that's really what the film is trying to answer. That's the question that I'm trying to answer in the film is really, you know, in reloading Marx, in other words, in bringing Marx forward from the past into the present, are we kind of losing something or are we gaining something from Marx? I think that's the question that Slavoj Žižek and Alan Badiou are asking in these Idea of Communism conferences. I mean, the first was held in London in 2009, and then you have the second in Berlin in 2010. And some of that is actually, we use clips from that conference in the film, so you can see some of that second Communism conference in the film. But that's really the challenge, I think. I'm not sure whether we did such a bad job with this, but, you know, in using someone like Marx, who is very much part of the kind of 19th century culture and society, how much can he really tell us about the time in which we're living, which obviously is a capitalism which is quite different in certain fundamental respects from the capitalism that he knew?
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Marx Reloaded, the film by Jason Barker, my guest. Let's hear a clip from an audio clip from that film.
What was Karl Marx's approach to thinking the economic system we call capitalism? How do his ideas help us understand a system which has come to dominate so many aspects of our lives?
As a thinker, I would characterize Marx principally as a brilliant theorist of capitalism. But as well as being a theorist of capitalism, he was also the leader of a political movement and what I would call a utopian theorist. What I mean is that he believed he'd discovered a kind of logic in history, a kind of logic of human development, a logic of the development of the entire species, whose built-in endpoint, although it might not be achieved, was a condition of universal freedom.
There's a beautiful phrase by, or expression by Ernst Bloch, writing about Marx, where he says, well, Marx is often accused for having this uncompromising, you know, brutalizing, kind of impersonal thinking. And Bloch says, well, you know, this is a result of Marx having to think like capitalism. So he says, just like the best detective has to think like a criminal, the best detective has to enter into the mentality of the criminal, which is a very dangerous practice. And of course, many Marxists who have tried to think like capitalism have effectively become apologists of capitalism, and that might be the reason why. But that, in a sense, is, I think, a great way of understanding Marx's method and the energy and combativeness of his thought. You know, what does it mean for a detective to think like a criminal?
A spectre is haunting Europe. The spectre of communism. All the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this spectre. Pope and Tsar, Metternich and Giesel, French radicals and German police spies.
The Communist Manifesto is Marx's most famous political work. It seems light years away from our modern liberal concerns. Then again, could it be that the class conflicts of the past between rich and poor, or capitalists and proletarians, are returning to haunt the present? Today, Marx remains indispensable reading for a new generation of politically motivated philosophers. Among them, Nina Power.
The Communist Manifesto has always had really interestingly delayed effects in history. You know, it's not a book, even though it's written with this tone of urgency because it's a manifesto, it's this kind of, you know, breathless text in a way. Nevertheless, the kind of real effects of that weren't sort of seen for kind of, you know, 50 or so years later. And I think, you know, it goes through various reiterations, you know, reappears and, you know, its relevance and different parts of it are stressed at different times.
Is capitalism. Capitalism is an economic system driven by the profit motive. According to Marx, capitalism thrives on the exploitation of the working class. In order to make a profit, the capitalist pays his workers less than the true value of their labor time. For Marx, such exploitation was the main cause of social conflict, or class struggle, between capitalists determined to increase their profits and workers struggling to earn a living.
Bottom level, I mean, you know, there really are only two classes and you know, one of them exploits the other.
But do Marxist theories of exploitation and class struggle still hold true today? Or is the way in which capitalists make their profits changing? Slavoj Žižek is a Slovenian philosopher at the forefront of a popular revival in Marxist and communist thinking.
It's obvious, and Marx already had an idea vague of it, that with knowledge emerging as a central factor of wealth production, this classical logic of exploitation no longer works. Vulgar example, Bill Gates owns what Marx calls part of our general intellect, the substance, our symbolic substance, means of communication, and it's as if in order for us to communicate among ourselves, we have to pay him a rent. So, and also this, I think, changes the very definition of what is proletariat today. Proletarian position is no longer just the working class. It's no longer typical, even to be a little bit cynical today. It's almost as if most of the protests today, protests of the unemployed and so on, are ironically sustained by a demand, please, provide us a job where we can be at least in a normal way exploited.
And that's a clip from the film Marx Reloaded. Jason Barker is my guest. He wrote and directed the film, which examines the relevance of Karl Marx's ideas for today. Jason has taught widely on film, media theory, and philosophy. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Cardiff University. So how did you go about, Jason, determining who you would have on as, you know, the scholar, the expert, the declaimer on Marxist thought? I'm counting here. You have about a dozen, you could call them talking heads, but, you know, that sort of ignores the fact that they're saying incredibly insightful and interesting things. You have about 12 people you feature in this film. What kind of criteria did you use in deciding who to invite on?
I guess the first important criterion, really the crucial one, was not to make a film where you just have people that are arguing for and against Marx and Marxism. What you have in the film is a whole bunch of people from just about, I mean, not from the extremes of the political spectrum, but you have just about every shade of grey in the film. As I said before, there's no longer any one Marxism. So, you know, you have people like Peter Sloterdijk in the film, who kind of describes himself as someone on the left. I'm not sure he's a Marxist exactly, but he's written quite a lot about Marx. You have Jacques Rancière, who is kind of like a utopian communist. Again, not exactly a Marxist, but comes from a kind of Marxist tradition. Then you have like Antonio Negri, who's a kind of existential Marxist, I guess you could describe him as. Michael Hart, probably in the same category, more or less. They've written books together, those two. You know, you have someone like Herfried Munkler, who's like a kind of Marxologist. He's the editor of Marx and Engels' Complete Works. He's a slightly more orthodox Marxist. You have someone like Alberto Toscano, who's, I guess, a kind of orthodox Marxist, but he's much younger. He's been influenced by a lot of French Marxism and Italian Marxism. So again, that's another tradition. So, you know, basically, I mean, I could go on, right? But basically, yeah, the idea was to show people that, you know, Marxism is not just one thing. There's not just one philosophy behind it. It covers a whole range of opinion. And, I mean, that was important because, again, it's important to break this cliche where, you know, Marxism is, you know, it's regarded as dogmatic, right? So, you know, people who are against Marxism usually say it's this and it's that and it's bad because of this and that and so on. Well, in actual fact, the interesting thing about Marxism is it's not dogmatic. It has a lot of different shades of grey.
The film could have gotten bogged down in a lot of Marxist theoretical minutiae, and you managed not to do that, and I'm sure that was a conscious decision. It's very accessible. And what struck me about the film is that it relates theory to leftist and radical and revolutionary politics. And I know that's been a long-time focus of yours. Can you talk about that, the importance of relating ideas to the real world and to social change, whether it's happened already or it will happen now or will happen in the future?
I think that's a really interesting question, but at the same time, it's a really difficult question, actually. I mean, for example, I mean, whenever you start talking about communism, you, as far as I can see, you already are in the realm of fantasy, right? I mean, this is the reason why we used, you know, the opening scene, the animation scene where Marx kind of, you know, comes back from the dead and meets Trotsky. I mean, there's a kind of reason behind that. I mean, obviously the Matrix movie was an important reference point, and it is throughout the whole film. But I think once you get into that territory, you are precisely asking questions about precisely how relevant Marx and Marxism and communism can be to the real world. I mean, that's an open question. I mean, it's not necessarily a question that's so easy to answer. I mean, in the film, you have this kind of, I mean, on the one hand, the film is just trying to make some kind of sense of the financial crisis that started in 2008. And the interesting thing about that whole crisis is, you know, is really around the same time, so the next year, 2009, you have this idea of communism conference in London. And then you have this kind of, you know, almost like a publishing frenzy going on, and people are publishing books about Marx and Marxism and capitalism. And is this the end of capitalism? Is this the beginning of communism? So, you know, there is certainly this, as you say, this kind of potential relation between what's happening in the real world, this crisis of capitalism, and this theory, this communist theory or Marxist theory. But again, I'm not really sure about how we should understand that relationship. I mean, this is really what the film is trying to explore. Are we just talking, when we talk about communism? Are we just talking about theory? Are we actually talking about something which has any purchase on the real world and what's happening and the crisis of capitalism? But I think that's really the question that, I'd like the viewers to try and work out for themselves. It's not really a question for me. What relevance, if you like, does this theory have?
That's Jason Barker, writer and director of the film Marx Reloaded. Let's listen to some more audio excerpts from that film.
The kind of capitalism that has entered into crisis is a capitalism that is producing ever more of what Marx called superfluous populations or surplus populations. What Mike Davis in The Planet of Slums has called a kind of surplus humanity. That is to say, it's not entirely clear that capitalism as it exists today needs people, needs workers in the same way that it needed before.
Capital functions through crises. So crisis doesn't mean the demise of capital. Capital functions by breaking down. It's a paradoxical way of working, but that's the way it works. And often what happens, this is of course one of the things that's happening as a result of the 2008 economic and financial crisis, is that crisis allows the possibility for new concentrations of capital, sometimes through privatization, sometimes simply through the concentration of wealth or power in fewer hands.
There's a way in which kind of capitalism is undead. You know, it keeps going even though, you know, no one has any faith in it anymore. No one believes in it, you know, and you know, this idea of a kind of free market was always a joke, but it's even more of a joke now. I mean, you know, the level of state intervention, you know, we're seeing the way in which this kind of plays out badly for the losers. I mean, look at what's happening in Greece at the moment.
Excerpts from a film. It's called Marx Reloaded. It's a film by Jason Barker that examines the relevance of Karl Marx's ideas for the contemporary world. We'll return to more excerpts, audio excerpts of the film, as well as my conversation with Jason Barker. In a few minutes, I want to let people know what we have on offer today, because we are in the middle of KPFA's Spring Fund Drive. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. For a $120 pledge, which you can break down into six installments if you like, for a $120 pledge, you get the film on DVD. It's called Marx Reloaded, and the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or simply 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Hey KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. We also have a wonderful combo pack, because we've paired Marx Reloaded, the film, with the book, The Communist Manifesto, a roadmap to history's most important political document. It's a book edited by Phil Gasper, who used to teach in Northern California, actually, and he's been interviewed on Against the Grain in the past. This book, The Communist Manifesto, a roadmap to history's most important political document, which includes the full text of the manifesto, commentaries, annotations, and additional works by Marx and Engels. That and Marx Reloaded is yours for a $180 pledge to KPFA. And you can break that down into six installments of $30 a month. So you can get the film alone, or you can get the film and something to read and learn a lot from, this book edited by Phil Gasper that Howard Zinn calls indispensable. That book is available to you for an $80 pledge, but the discounted combo pack of the film and the book is available for a $180 pledge to KPFA. These are your thank you gifts for giving to KPFA and allowing this kind of information to continue coming to your ears. You can think about how many times you've heard discussions of Karl Marx on commercial media and on what I might call mainstream public media. And then you can think about how often you hear radical ideas on KPFA. 1-800-439 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can donate online at kpfa.org. $120 or $20 a month gets you the film Marks Reloaded. And $180 or $30 a month gets you the film and the book. The film, Marks Reloaded, has been showcased at numerous universities and festivals around the world, including Columbia University, Duke University, the London School of Economics, Goldsmiths College, Belgrade University, Kyung-hee University in Seoul, Shanghai Jiao Tong University. The list goes on and on. Featured commentators include Slavoj Žižek, who is a very prominent radical public intellectual, Michael Hart, who we had on the radio recently, talking about his and Antonio Negri's latest book, Assembly. Antonio Negri is also part of this. Jacques Rancière, who I think visited Berkeley recently to give a talk. And Nina Power, a philosopher in London, who I think I first heard about her through this film. Alberto Toscano, a sociologist. It includes animated sequences. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of serious talk, but the animated sequences impart a kind of a lighter feel. A lighthearted feel to this film. It leavens the content as the film follows Marx's adventures through the matrix of his own ideas. Very interesting film, well praised, well critiqued, and I'm so delighted to be able to offer you this film for $120, or the film and the book, The Communist Manifesto, A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document, for a $180 pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Let's go back now to more of my conversation with Jason Barker, writer and director of the film Marks Reloaded.
The theory of commodity fetishism describes how we accept value as a natural quality of things. But according to Marx, such belief is an illusion. Every commodity, like every value, must be produced. Even something as seemingly natural as water is commodified, purified, packaged and transported to the customer, a process from which the capitalist duly extracts a profit.
Value is in the eye of the beholder. Value doesn't exist in objects.
What I would say is that commodity fetishism is only the capitalist version of a type of objectification which is humanly universal.
Is this the real world? Or are we the victims of a marketplace that seduces us, mystifying our senses with its fantasy objects? For Marx, commodities exist not to satisfy our needs, nor because they are really useful to us, but simply to be bought and sold.
Fetishism is an illusion which is part of reality itself. You have this wonderful double reversal that things are the way they are. You may be conscious how things really are, but in your practice you follow an illusion of which you are not conscious.
Well, I think our tendency to over-invest importance in particular objects is a matter of human psychology rather than of economics. It's the way we are, and we follow fashion, for example. So we look and see what are the great celebrities wearing or eating or driving, and we want one of those. And that's human nature. The economic system is morally neutral on this subject. It simply produces what people want.
How does commodity fetishism apply to the new social networks of the information age? Is it possible that the commodity extends from what we buy to the very core of who we are?
The modern media, so to speak, colonize, partly create and partly colonize, partly mobilize collective fantasies. I think that sort of transcends anything which you find in Marx, because the technology and the level of development wasn't such that it permitted that kind of insight at that time.
The commodity or consumer way of life is everywhere and in everything we do. We see the world through commodity eyes, so that every social encounter becomes a potential sale, not just of material possessions, but of our individual selves.
And again, those are audio excerpts of a film called Marx Reloaded. Jason Barker is my guest. From, of all places, Seoul, South Korea, he is writer and director of that film, and he's also author of Alain Badiou, A Critical Introduction, Badiou being an important and influential French theorist and philosopher. He has taught widely on film, media theory, and philosophy, Jason has. And, well, speaking of a French based philosophers and thinkers, two of the, you know, the kind of heavyweights that you profile and that you feature in this film, Marx Reloaded, are Jacques Rancière, who is a philosopher, professor emeritus at the University of Paris. He gained a lot of fame by co-authoring the book Reading Capital in the 1960s, as in reading Marx's Capital. And also Antonio Negri, the Italian Marxist sociologist, philosopher, and author. And as you said, he co-authored with Michael Hart a number of very influential books on radical theory, empire, multitude, commonwealth. Michael Hart has been a guest on Against the Grain more than once. But specifically Negri and Rancière, and obviously they have written and said so many things on so many topics. So how did you strategize what you wanted the focus of your conversations with Rancière and Negri to be? And can you talk a little bit about that portion, that sequence of your film in which you sort of alternate back and forth between Negri and Rancière, and what that counterposition was about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, I mean, I could probably pretend at this moment that was, that we planned it like that. We didn't, actually, although it was something that was planned rather late in the day. I think Rancière was the final interview that I did, and Negri was probably the first or the second, I think. I think he was the second. I think we interviewed Negri second, right before we interviewed Zizek. I mean, Rancière and Negri, they're both, as you say, they're both from a kind of similar generation. Negri's slightly older, and I think Negri's kind of more, let's say, politically orthodox, let's say, and was politically active right the way through the early part of his life. You know, as a young man, he would be involved with kind of workers' struggles and strikes and that type of thing in Italy. So he was much more into the kind of active an organizational side of politics than Rancière was, although also Rancière was politically active in the 60s and 70s. So I don't want to exaggerate the differences between them, although Negri is slightly older. But that exchange, I suppose, between Negri and Rancière, what can we say about it? I suppose Negri is really saying that, you know, capitalism is providing the kind of revolutionary energy that people today can, you know, in some way transform against the system, right? So, you know, Negri has this, there's this famous remark that he always makes and which he made in the film, which is there is no way out of capital. We're already inside it. So we have to struggle inside it and try and transform it from within. I think Rancière takes a slightly different view in the sense that he doesn't really see any good in capitalism. He doesn't really see any potential within capitalism for transforming it.
Jason, tell us about the animated sequences in the film. As you mentioned at one point, I think it's at the very beginning, I think as you said, so you have the animated Karl Marx, and he's walks into a room, and it looks like a Matrix sequence from the Matrix films. And then you have the guy in the sunglasses who turns out to be Leon Trotsky, and Trotsky eventually presents Marx with a choice between, you can take the blue pill, you can take the red pill, and one of those pills will show him what the reality is behind the appearances. Why did you choose to include animated sequences interspersed throughout the film?
I suppose on one level, the animation is kind of providing, you know, just it's a bunch of comic interludes in a documentary film. I mean, I could answer very simply by saying it was fun. It is fun actually. It was fun to make. I mean, there's a bit of background here which I should probably mention in the sense that I've been trying to make a fully animated feature film about Karl Marx for almost 10 years now. It's still in development, actually. I mean, that film is really the film that I always wanted to make. So, you know, I have to be honest here and say that, the idea for that was another film, actually. And the opportunity to make this particular film came very quickly, and so I thought, okay, why not? Let me use this opportunity to put some animation in the film. But, I mean, there is, I think, on the other hand, a really good reason why that animation should be in the film, and that's to do with the fact, and I've kind of been talking about some of this already, but that's kind of to do with the fact that when you start talking about communism, you're already in the fantasy world. You're already in Disneyland. So, you know, in that sense, you know, it's trying to explore that fantasy land. You know, that allegedly there is a kind of fantasy element to that. So, you know, using animation is almost like a comment on that, a comment on the kind of weird and wonderful world of communism, right? I suppose, again, the other reason that I used the animation was, you know, in order to try and find or try and retrieve some of the subversive potential of Marx's ideas.
That's Jason Barker, writer and director of the documentary film Marx Reloaded. Let's hear another excerpt from that film.
People are trying to think about, you know, different ways of living sustainably, to try and create these kind of homeostatic modes of existence where there is no waste, you know, and maybe even live in a kind of collective way or a, you know, hint at a communal way of living. You know, and I think people do feel a real kind of need sometimes, or a desire for that sort of, a simpler but kind of more creative and more interesting life, you know, to have proper relations with people that aren't mediated through this kind of, you know, commodity fetishism.
Today, there is growing disquiet in Western societies on a range of social, economic, and environmental questions. A new generation of Marx-inspired thinkers sees ecology as a decisive political issue.
The management of the ecological common of the air, the earth, the atmosphere by private property and even by states has led us to the brink of disaster. But similarly, I think in economic terms, we're ever more handicapped in our, even in economic functioning, by the rule of private property and even the mechanisms of accumulation through profit.
Communism in the sense of we are dealing with a commons. Our earth as natural substance, somehow we have to manage it together.
If you look at the common in communism, it gives you a very different view than we've inherited from either from Soviet ideology or from U.S. anti-communist ideology.
excerpts, audio excerpts from a film, a beautifully produced film called Marx Reloaded, written and directed by Jason Barker, who you heard me speak with. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and listener-sponsored KPFA. And we are in the second week of KPFA's Spring Fun Drive. I want to play a little bit more from that film, but we'll give you plenty of time to go to your phones or to give a call and to support KPFA and support the delivery of this kind of information and support this information and also get yourself, support yourself by getting, as a thank you gift, this film, this full-length film, Marx Reloaded, by Jason Barker. And it is available to you as a thank you gift for a $120 pledge to KPFA, $120 or more. And you ask for Marx Reloaded, and we will send you the DVD. You can break that down into six monthly installments of $20 per month. No, you don't have to pay all of the installments before you get this film. Talk to the phone room at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's a very easy way to remember our phone number. You're calling out to us, hey, KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. And the companion gift is this beautiful book. It's called The Communist Manifesto, A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document, edited by Phil Gasper. Howard Zinn says of this book that it comes at a critical moment in world history when a global capitalism, which Marx described with amazing accuracy 150 years ago, shows all the signs of disarray that he predicted. What Gasper does is to remind us how relevant the manifesto is to our world today. His introduction and afterword are useful guides to the manifesto and to its importance in our time. His notes give us fascinating tidbits of information which a thoughtful reader of the manifesto will find extremely valuable. Gasper brings alive one of the great classics of modern political thought, and indispensable addition to anyone's library. That's Howard Zinn talking about this book, The Communist Manifesto, A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document, which includes the full text of the manifesto, along with commentaries and annotations and additional works by Marx and Engels. That comes your way with Marx Reloaded for the discounted pledge rate of $180 to KPFA, which is $30 a month. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. According to one critic, the film Marx Reloaded creates a compelling dialogue of Marx's theories as they apply to the contemporary free market system. Another calls it lively, well worth a watch for those with an interest in philosophy, politics, and the general state of the world as we know it. And I have another, and Louis Project from the Counterpunch really likes it. He says he can't recommend this film highly enough. The film is a fast-paced and even exciting treatment of Marx's ideas. Simon Critchley also highly recommends this film. I recommend this film. I watched this film. I learned a lot from this film. It's packed with information. And then, of course, also the animated sequences are a lot of fun and are very inventive and interesting. So Jason Barker, he's a professor. He's the maker of this film, but he is a thinker in his own right. He's a professor at the European Graduate School in Switzerland. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Cardiff University. His longtime focus has been on the relation of theory to leftist politics, and this is an abiding interest of mine and of Sasha's. And we do highlight ideas and theory on Against the Grain. And if you appreciate that, if you like that, if you find it kind of unique and kind of quirky and interesting and educational and insightful, the people that we have on talking about ideas and left ideas and progressive ideas and especially radical ideas, give us a call. Support us, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And again, $120 for the film Marx Reloaded as your thank you gift, $180 for the book, The Communist Manifesto, and the film Marx Reloaded. A lot to think about and chew over and to read and to watch and to hopefully share maybe with other people. That's $180 for both the book and the film. And we've been given a match, as we seem to be given every day, this fund drive. And it comes from Jim in Oakland and Stan and Mariana in San Rafael. And I want to thank Jim and Stan and Mariana because I can see the amounts that they've put up as a match. Combined, it comes to $835. So we have 12 and a half minutes left to make this match of $835. They've come forward, but they've said, no, we want to make a conditional pledge, conditional on other people, not just us, stepping up to support KPFA, stepping up to support the kinds of ideas they hear on programs like Against the Grain. Marx was born 200 years ago, almost to the day. He was voted the greatest living philosopher. This was a poll taken, I believe, in the UK not too long ago. An incredibly influential thinker. I thought I saw also some study that, or some article that indicated that he was like the most cited scholar, the most influential scholar of all time, which, you know, I mean, there are a lot of scholars who are cited all the time who I might not agree with or you might not agree with, but Marx's ideas have great circulation, and many scholars in the Marxist or Marxian tradition have appeared on Against the Grain and talked about Karl Marx's ideas and their application to the present. And maybe you appreciate that. Maybe you appreciate the level of discourse and the application of a lot of radical ideas and radical theory to what's happening today. There's so much going on every day, and on Against the Grain, we do like to step back and provide some context and provide some insight into the ideologies and sometimes that affect us and often dominate us, and the ideas and theories that point toward social justice, toward emancipation, toward a new way of living, a new way of being, a new way of governing ourselves. 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org, kpfa.org. And there you will find all kinds of thank you gifts. So if you, you know, you can kind of do a little bit of shopping if you like to think of it that way, although these are all thank you gifts for your donation of support to listener-supported KPFA. But you will find all kinds of thank you gifts. You can choose what you like, and you can pledge securely. We've already gotten pledges from someone in Richmond, Virginia. I would love to hear from the East Coast. Mapleton, Oregon. Love to hear from the Pacific Northwest. Richmond, California. Love to hear from the Bay Area. We would love to hear from anyone who benefits from Against the Grain, benefits from KPFA, finds it of value to what they do, how they think, how they approach the world, how they perceive political developments, social developments, cultural trends. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Let's hear just a little bit more from this film. This is, the film is Marx Reloaded, and it's written and directed by Jason Barker.
Is the idea of communism a fantasy? Is communism only realizable in our imagination?
It can't be some kind of utopian fantasy about what comes after the apocalypse. You know, people are thinking all the time about this kind of the end of the world, and this kind of, you know, somehow it's supposed to be easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism.
The end point is knowledge. Things are getting so rational because, you know, there is the paradox of knowledge. Everybody knows, or of intellectual property, is that with ordinary material property, we have a competition, because if we have here a nice steak, if I eat it, then you don't eat it. No, you know what I mean? Like, through use, it gets used. With knowledge, it's the opposite. If I know something and tell it to you, knowledge not only doesn't get used in the sense of Less functional, true, but it even gets rich. Knowledge as commodity is effectively an anti-capitalist commodity.
Slavoj Žižek, who is one of the featured thinkers in this film, Marx Reloaded, I just found it really, really fascinating and educational. And, you know, I've read a fair amount of Marx, and we've been taught many things about Marx by people who've appeared on this program. But I found it really interesting, very well put together, and I commend it to you. And your dollars are doubled. Your dollars are doubled by Jim and Stan and Mariana, and they have put up money, but they believe that there are other people out there who really care about KPFA and who really want KPFA to continue and who want ideas that are not part of the mainstream in this country for one reason or another. We could spend hours talking about that, and in some ways we have spent hours talking about that on Against the Grain. But this is your chance to get a nice dose of Slavoj Žižek, who is sort of a rock star in the realms of political and cultural theory, and Michael Hart, again, who we had on recently, and Nina Power and Jacques Rancière and Antonio Negri, who is Michael Hart's collaborator on many things, and John Gray, who's an English political philosopher and writer. If you like the coverage we've given to Marxist and other radical ideas over the years, over the many years, please express your support for that by making a pledge now at 1-800-439-5732. That's the phone number. It's toll-free, 1-800-439-5732. For $20 a month over 6 months, you get this film, Marx Reloaded. It is in a DVD box set. And what do you get in return? Well, yeah, you get that film as your thank you gift, but you also get KPFA. You get the satisfaction of knowing you've given to something that you care about and you believe in and that cares about you. We produce, Sasha and I produce, always with you in mind, what would interest you or intrigue you or motivate you or inspire you or enlighten you. We're always thinking about you and what we can do for you. And you're giving back. You're giving back to something because you, in return, care about it and want to reciprocate and stand in solidarity, to use a term loaded with radical history. Radical historical significance. You want to stand in solidarity with something that you care about. 1-800-439-5732. And again, we have this fantastic, in my opinion, combo pack of the film Marx Reloaded and the book The Communist Manifesto, A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document. Alan Wood says, the more those in power reject and ignore Marx and his ideas, the more the world comes to resemble the barbaric social system Marx predicted capitalism was in the process of becoming. Therefore, Marx's ideas are becoming more and more relevant to understanding what we see before us. This edition of the Communist Manifesto, and this is, again, part of our combo pack of $180, with its excellent informative notes and commentaries, enables the reader to appreciate this document both historically and theoretically, both in relation to its own time and in relation to the realities around us. 1-800-439-5732. Since it was first written in 1848, the manifesto has been translated into more languages than any other modern text. The manifesto has been translated into more languages than any other modern text since it was first written in 1848. It has been banned, censored, burned, and declared dead. But year after year, the text only grows more influential, remaining required reading in courses on philosophy, politics, sociology, economics, and history. That's yours for an $80 pledge if you want the book alone. This book edited by Phil Gasper, which includes, of course, the entire text of the Communist Manifesto, in addition to all the commentaries and annotations. If you want the film alone, Marx Reloaded, for $120, that's $20 a month, and you can get the book and the DVD for $180 pledge to KPFA. I want to thank James Johnson in San Francisco. He made a pledge. Thank you, James. Gary Steyer in Fresno, possibly, or Fregno. I think it's Fresno. Thank you, Gary. Other people have called and pledged because, you know, some people don't mind being thanked on air and some people do. So we don't mention the other listeners. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We have $410 to make in the next 3.5 minutes. So we've made some money toward our match, but we still have $410 left to make. So if three of you pledge for Mark's Reloaded, and one of you, or four of you pledge for Mark's Reloaded, doing my math in my head here, or a couple of you pledge for the combo pack of the book and the DVD, and one of you pledges for Mark's Reloaded, then we will get to our match of $835. But there is no time to waste. It's not too late to call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And if you are the caller who takes us over the top, your pledge essentially means $835 for us, because if you're the one who calls and makes that final pledge to take us over $835 collectively from all of you, then we get $835 from Jim and Stan and Mariana. Join them, join KPFA, join this effort, this bizarre, it is a bizarre effort. It's a bizarre initiative to present ideas like this that are just rejected and dismissed by the mainstream, that are laughed at in so many circles. And I'm not just talking about conservative circles. I'm talking about moderate circles and many liberal circles. This kind of information, if you take it for granted and if you don't give, there is the danger that we go away, that we are no longer part of your life or the life of people who come after you. Because when you give, you allow us to continue so that somebody else tunes in to KPFA or KFCF or KPFA.org and hears something that just might blow their mind and just might open entire vistas into new ways of thinking and doing. It's all about, not just about thinking, it's about thinking and doing. Mark's Reloaded, this film, $120. It means $240 to us right now because your dollars are doubled. $180 for the combo book and the combo book and DVD, $180. That becomes $360 because of this still outstanding match. I don't know how close we are. We were $410 away about 2 minutes ago. 1-800-439-5732. The film is informed and intelligent and accessible. And if you agree that the ideas of Marx should be, need to be taken seriously at this, our current historical moment, get the film, learn, be entertained, be enlightened. And also, again, if you like the coverage we've given to Marxist thought and other radical thought over the years, then we need to hear from you. And management would love to hear from you.